Good morning, and welcome to the Board of Directors for Chenan County PUD. It's a regular commission meeting. It is Monday, March 5th, 2018. Four commissioners present, and Commissioner Congdon on the phone. You are there this morning, Commissioner?
Yes, I am. Thanks, Dan.
Good. Good to hear your voice, Ann. And excuse me. Let me remind you that if you have a cell phone, could you please put it in a position that it won't disturb the meeting? And if you would like to address the commission, you're certainly welcome to do so. But please approach the microphone at first, introduce yourself and your address, and then utilize the reasonable length of time to share your concern. With that being said, we would like to open our meeting with the Pledge of Allegiance and Safety Minute with Ian Adams.
I pledge
allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Good morning. My name is Ian Adams, and I'm here to deliver this month's Safety Minute. When I was preparing for this presentation, I got thinking, what's March about? What safety awareness is the month of March trying to bring to our attention? And I found a list of different things. There's a number of them. One of which was, it's National Workplace Eye Wellness Month. Eye wellness and safety are a really big, important things to me, because I'm a sufferer of glaucoma, had cataracts when I was in kindergarten, and I've had what's known as a interocular venal occlusion, which left me blind in my left eye for a period of time. Unfortunately, I recovered from that, mostly. But because of that, I take eye wellness and health very, very seriously. Show of hands, how many in here have ever heard of the hazards of blue light? Great. There's a few of us. That's more than I expected, actually. Blue light is a natural light. If you think of the rainbow, blue light is on the innermost side of the rainbow. It's the cold spectrum of the cold end of the light spectrum. It's a very short wave, but very high energy light wave that is visible just prior to light turning into a non-visible light energy. Blue light is super important because it does a number of things. It regulates our circadian rhythm, which is our sleep-wake cycle. It affects our mood, and it makes the sky blue. But blue light has an alter ego. Blue light is not necessarily good for us. Fortunately, the natural blue light that is all around us at all times is refracted by dust particles in the atmosphere. It's refracted by buildings, trees, things of that nature. However, unfortunately, fluorescent and LED lights, personal devices like computer screens, cell phones, iPads, they all produce blue light. And what's even more unfortunate is that we spend hours, oftentimes, sitting there focused directly on these devices. And the relative newness of these devices, there's no long-term research that tells us just how harmful these devices are. But blue light is known to cause macular degeneration, eye strain-related headaches, and even different forms of ocular cancer. The best thing we can do is learn about the hazards of blue light. There's a lot of easy things we can do. I see Eric's using an iPad there. Apple has software built into those that will regulate. It's user-defined. It will regulate how much blue light is emit by these devices. We can buy shades that will cover our monitors, and our prescription glasses can be outfit with filters that will help filter out blue light. The side effect of these different devices is everything kind of takes a yellow tint, but once you get used to it, you don't even notice it anymore. I encourage every one of you to do a little bit of research on Google, find out how you can prevent a little bit of this blue light, and just try and limit your screen time. Thank you, Mr. Commissioner.
Thank you. Any questions?
Yeah, I have one. Ian, I haven't met you before. Where in the utility are you located?
I work for the Fish and Wildlife Department. I'm the Hatchery Maintenance and Operations Coordinator for the district.
Great. Nice to meet you.
Very good.
Thank you.
Nice. Thank you. Good presentation. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Ian.
Thanks, Ian.
Commission, let's take a look at the agenda and the approval of it. Any thoughts, concerns, changes? Anything need to be modified? Okay, hearing none, we'll just move on then. Number three, Rocky Reach, Pacific Lamprey Passage.
I invite Steve Hemstrom and Aline Underwood up to describe some pretty good news, actually, about Lamprey Passage.
Well, this is meant to be a compliment. So lamprey are really interesting creatures, and Lamprey Passage almost defies logic. So I am interested in hearing about the passage.
So, Commissioner, when you say they're really interesting creatures, is that another word for really ugly?
Well, that, and, I know that sometimes they're consumed. I'm not referring to that either, but they're such a prehistoric entity still surviving in this day and age that they are unique.
They are, and that's why we're excited to talk to you today.
Yeah.
So, good morning. Steve mentioned my name is Lane Underwood. I manage the district's Fish and Wildlife Program. Here with me is Steve Hemstrom. He is one of our senior fisheries biologists in the Fish and Wildlife Department. May not have seen Steve in a while, but he actually just had his 15-year anniversary last month. So he's been in the district for 15 years.
Yeah.
And mostly he was involved with instrumental in doing our survival studies that completed in about 2011. So since then, Steve's been working really hard on implementing the new terms and conditions of our Rocky Reach license, so our Lamprey Management Plan being one of them. So that's what we're here to talk about today. With that, I'll turn it over to Steve.
Wonderful. Thanks, Aline. So we'll get going on this presentation.
It should be open at the bottom there.
Thank you.
There we go.
Well, I'll start by just saying we have no decisions with this presentation. We're requesting of you just a very good story, good information we wanted you to hear. We've got four things in this presentation we want to talk about, and these are them here. The biology of the lamprey, as you probably may know, that they are very unique critters, been around a long time, and so that's why they're very interesting to talk about. They are difficult to study. We're going to talk about the license management plan. Rocky Reach has a Pacific Lamprey Management Plan in it. We have to meet those objectives. One of those is adult passage requirements. When we say adults, passage requirements are at the dam, and we're going to talk about that today. The passage studies and the results, and those are really the good news in today's story for us. And we've been at it since 2004, really, our first study. And then our next steps. We've achieved a good step, and we're going to tell you what we're going to do next. Biology. Native to the Columbia River, so these creatures have been around for about 450 million years, one of the longest, even longer than sturgeon, which has been in the river for a very long time. They have no bones. They have no jaws. They have no paired fins, and they're weak swimmers. Told the senior team that they have cartilage, all they have in their body. Fantastic critters. They are parasitic in the ocean, which means they're not predators. They don't eat you all the way. They attach to you. And if you're a fish. So
there's a pleasant picture, isn't it? Yes.
Parasitic in the ocean. A key point is that they're genetically indistinct. Most fish, you know, most animals are genetically based in where they live. They actually can be separated from other groups of the same species, but not Pacific lamprey. They spawn in freshwater streams. And a key point here, too, is not their natal stream, like salmon. You've heard come back to the same stream where they were born to spawn when they're adults. And like salmon, they die after spawning.
So a question, Steve, if they have no jaws, what do they use for intake?
They use something called an oral disc, which is a round suction cup mouth.
Okay.
So they don't have a biting, up and down biting process like a salmon does. They have more like a suction cup. You can think about that in your shower when you stick your coffee cup holder in there. That's pretty much what lamprey.
You have a coffee cup holder in your shower?
It's working at all times.
Okay. Well, yeah.
It's a high standard.
Okay. So would that be similar to a leech?
Similar to a leech, yes.
Okay.
Yep. Very, very similar, Commissioner. So this was a wonderful picture. This shows you Bonneville Dam, 2017. This is one of the fishway windows at Bonneville where the public can come through and take a look at what's going on. And there was a record run in 2017, 1,000-plus lamprey, and this is what they were looking at. So this is really good news. and the commissioner asked about what do they look like in terms of their mouths. So on your lower right there is an inset of what they call the oral disc. And you see those poorly brushed teeth there. that's called a radula. Anyway, that thing rasps a hole through fish. They'll be onto whales, dolphins, anything they can get a hold of. And that's how they live in the ocean for up to 3 years. So what is the Rocky Beach Lamprey Management Plan? I'll tell you a little bit about that here. It had several pieces. One was to modify a fishway to improve lamprey passage. And once we did that, that actually occurred in 2011, 2012. Then we had to test those improvements and those modifications to make sure that they worked as we intended. And we had to measure passage rates of adult lampreys in the fishway at Rocky Beach. And ultimately achieve passage similar to the best rates on the Columbia River. And when that was done, determine if any other unavoidable effects were in the fishway for adult lamprey that we could take care of additionally. So I wanted to show you.
Was that the stainless steel plates put in the bottom that they attached to?
Yes, it was.
Again, is it the same oral attachment to the plate?
Yes.
Okay.
You are correct. And a couple others I'll show you here.
Okay.
Yep. So now here's the entrances to the Rock Beach Fishway. You may or may not know it has a single fishway, but there are three entrances. So you were pointing there with arrows. There's a spillway entrance. There's an upper powerhouse entrance in the middle there. And on your left there is the lower powerhouse entrance. And they all lead to the same place in the Rocky Beach Fishway. We didn't modify these entrances. They worked pretty darn well for adult lamprey to enter the fishway. The modifications we made were inside the fishway, so I'm going to show you those. 2011, as we mentioned, the improvements made. This is an attachment ramp. So before we did this, aluminum plating, envision what that looks like without it. And salmon, steelhead, go through it just fine. This is unwatered. This fishway has no water in it, obviously. For lamprey, we built these ramps that help the adults attach with their mouth. And then burst up and reattach. So they climb what they call a grip and climb, an attach, release, swim. Attach, release, swim. And they do that for miles. How they do it, no one really quite knows it, because we're at River Mile, 473 with Rocky Reach, and they do that the entire way on the bottom, climbing to rocks. But in the fishway, they have trouble without something like this. So we built this, the engineers, we got with them, the tribes, the agencies, and they said, this is what we know works, and we did it, and by golly. That's why I'm telling you a good story today. Here's the other thing you mentioned, Commissioner Bowles, is that these are the grating covers. So in the fishway, we have diffusion chambers that add water to the fishway, which help keep it in fluvial criteria, which means there's amount of water in the fishway that the head differentials are proper. We have to do that by adding water all the way down through the fishway. Prior to this grating, lamprey could actually slide down through the sides of the grating. So they would go down, instead of up the ladder, they would swim down into that flow system, and that was not good. So this does two things. The grating you see there is very narrow, so it keeps the fish from going in, and the side plates there that you see, they can just attach to those and swim right on up, and in your upper end there, you see, thank you, Lee, that's upstream, so they're going to need to go through that little orifice there, and they can slide right through by attaching and swimming and attaching and swimming. So these are two key pieces of those modifications that helped us get to where we are today. So getting to the good news, the adult passage rate studies, a little background. 2004, our initial study was with a radio tag. We don't use those anymore. I don't have one to show you, but with a radio tag as an external antenna, we estimated 47% passage, not a rate. So then we said, we're going to have to do some modifications. We did those in 2013, and then 14, we said we're going to use a half-duplex pit tag. That was the only pit tag that was approved for lamprey at that time, because we used one different, talk about here, that we used in salmon, full duplex tag, but they weren't allowed for lamprey at that point in time. And that's a bigger story. I can tell you a little bit about that if you want to hear it. But So that estimate was 70% with our half duplex tags. Then they approved this full duplex smaller tag. Actually, I've got tags. If you're curious, I brought them for you to show you the differences. I'll pass them around if you want to see them later. But 2016, we did a study. 2017, we're doing another study, 2 years worth, actually a total of three. And in those two studies, 98% estimated pasture efficiency for adult Pacific lamprey, which is amazing. So what does that mean to the district? That's the best passage rate on the river, and we have a passage objective at Rocky Reach, I mentioned, which was passage to the best, similar to the best on the Columbia River measured, and everybody has been measuring passage rates for adult lampreys. The very neat thing is we've set our own passage rate at 98%. There's no one better, which is fantastic. That's where everybody gets a hand. The engineers, the biologists, the fishway attendants at Rocky Reach, everyone who's been involved in doing this. So what are our next steps? We've got a great passage rate. What's left to do? We have to finish our 2017 study. These critters are in the river for a full year. They're not like salmon. When we get salmon, they're going to pass the ladder in the year that they enter fresh water, most of them. Lamprey overwinter a full year before they spawn. So that makes them hard to study. But we've got a full year to finalize this study in 2017. We tagged them in August. We'll finish it in August of 2018. And the next step would be with the Rocky Reach Fish Forum, which is the party that implements the objectives of the management plans. The Rocky Reach Fish Forum will give them a statement of agreement, SOA, and they will agree that the passage objective has been met for Rocky Reach, and that's a critically important step for us. And after that, we'll determine if there are additional measures that we can do or should do or need to do based on that best passage rate that we've achieved. And we're not quite sure about that. I know how we feel, and that is that we've done all we can do, and we've done a great job, so give us a thumbs up.
Steve, before you go, two questions. When you look at the photo of the on the left, the opening right between what appears to be the eyes,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is that an intake?
That's his, he uses it for breathing, but mm-hmm. also for a nostril. That's the water comes in there. They are very in tune to smells, and they use that as one of their ways to get water through their olfactory system.
Okay.
And the ones on the opposite side, those are it's called breathing pores. They don't have gills like fish.
Okay.
So, good question.
Yeah, those kind of look like they were made by Buick.
No, those are real, yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Do we have any videos of them actually moving up through the water?
We don't have any specifically we've taken. On the internet, there are. Yes, people do.
I'm going to have to look at that.
Okay. I mean,
just to visualize how they actually maneuver.
Yes, it's fantastic. This individual on the left-hand side there, it's moving a rock and making a red. They make a red, but they pick, instead of using a tail to move the rocks to make that red, they pick them up with their mouths and move them. So that's what that critter's doing right there.
Oh my gosh.
So, yeah, and that's really all we have. This is a very neat photo. This is Rocky Reach Fishway, the 27th of July in 2017. And we thought it was wonderful to say, do you have any questions?
Steve, this is Ann.
Hello, Ann.
Hi. Hey, I just well, first of all, congratulations. That's a great accomplishment.
Thank you.
And I may have missed it. I don't remember. Are lamprey listed or are they threatened? Which status are they?
They're neither. They're not on the Endangered
oh, really?
Species Act list at this point in time.
Oh.
But they are identified as
keep it that way.
I think they're identified as a conservation species, I recall. Is that right?
And they are. They're a species of concern, and they were petitioned for listing in 2003 or 2005, but that was rejected. So they're high on the list of watch for the year.
Right. Okay. Great. Thank you.
And I would just say there's a lot of work going in across the region to try to make sure that they don't end up on the threatened or endangered species list, and that's part of the reason why this is so important to be successful at this.
Mm.
Who preys on lamprey?
Everything.
Everything. Okay.
Yes, it's again, it's if you call bottom of the food chain a real phrase, that's what it is. As a juvenile lamprey, they are fed on by birds, by fish, by crawdads, by everything. And as adults, they are in the ocean. That's why they're parasitic and attached. If you're swimming and you look like that in the ocean, you get eaten. So that's why they attach. And when they're attached and feeding as parasites, they that's why they survive in the ocean. So everything does eat you. Yes.
I would actually also add to that that everything in the river eats you as well. So we have a white sturgeon management plan. Mm-hmm. So sturgeon are known to eat lamprey. And so as we move forward with implementing both of these plans together, that's something that we have to continue to pay attention to make sure the balance of those two plans are met.
So those lampreys that we're looking at right there, how long are they?
They are about 2.5 to 3.5 feet, 2.5, depending on their size. They're about 11 years old, 10 years old. I didn't tell you that. These are older guys. These are older fish. They're returned. They're about 10 years old, 2.5 to 3 feet, and fairly narrow.
And they'll spend a year in the river spawning. Do they then return to the ocean? Their life cycle doesn't end with spawning.
It does. Like salmon. They die after spawning, which is really important. They bring the nutrients from the ocean, and they deliver it right to the tributary streams. They're in the Eniat, the Wenatchee, the Methow. Not so much the Okanagan. They're trying to get them back in there. The tribes are.
So they just spawn once in their lifetime. And then, so talk about the trip back to the ocean for the youth. What are those called? I know what...
Those are called macrothalmia, which means macro means large eye, and thalmia means small. So juvenile is a maybe 3 inches long, 4 inches long, up to 7 years old before they head to the ocean. They live in the mud in the tributaries for up to 7 years before they go. That's another problematic piece of lamprey that makes them vulnerable, is that they can get eaten for a long period of time while they're rearing in the sediment. But they're very small. Like they're about that size, a pen right there. And they swim downstream on high flow events, and when the water at night, and when the water is turbid. So we have flow events that delivers sediment into the river. That moves downstream. That's when they get up out of the mud at night and they move. Very good question. If you move during the day and you look like that, you get eaten. So that's one of their critical,
interesting,
evolutionary good things they've done to stay alive. So.
Any other questions?
Yeah.
You said Rocky Reach. There's that. You said that you, Mike Chambers, Antiet, you said that you had 98% at Rocky Reach. Is that the same result you have at Rock Island?
We have not studied Rock Island like Rocky Reach as of yet. So we don't. We have to at Rocky Reach, and we believe it's fairly good at Rock Island, but we have not conducted those real physical studies at Rock Island.
Okay.
That's all we have.
I don't know what it is, but it's just fascinating. But thank you. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yes. Yeah.
Congratulations.
It is. Just, you know, sturgeon, and, you know, the different species that are prehistoric that have figured out a way to survive are just fascinating creatures. Never known for their beauty, but they're unique.
They've been called non-charismatic.
That's better than my ugly. Yeah.
They probably don't do a lot of susceptible to learning tricks, I'm guessing.
They are survivors.
So. They are survivors.
So,
yeah.
If you were to describe their benefit, like in a fish tank, you've got your bottom feeders that clean up the bottom. I mean, what can you describe their importance or benefit? So, food obviously must be one. And
yes, as prey, yes. But probably the most important is they're bringing nutrients from the ocean, dying after they spawn, and that their material is broken down, eaten by aquatic insects. That's probably one of the most important. And aquatic insects we know feed salmon steelhead in the stream a year or two later. And so it's that bringing in nutrients from the ocean, just like salmon do. But the biomass of lamprey, which used to be large, dying in streams was critically important to make them very highly productive.
Yeah, I see.
And I would also add that, you know, from a cultural perspective, these lamprey are very important to, you know, all the tribes that that we deal with. They're historically important part of their culture and their life. And so they're, Steve mentioned the conservation initiative that they're a part of with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And so from that perspective, they're really important.
Yeah. And, you know, the credit to our employee that makes ceramic copies of these and then fires them and mm-hmm. presents them to different Native American tribes. It's a great contribution.
It is.
So, got to love our employees.
Right.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Speaking of prehistoric and ugly, it's our legislative update.
Oh. Ow! I was trying to think of a nice segue. That was we could just leave this.
I'm not, referring to the presenter.
Oh, oh,
the okay. institution.
I see. And I'll just blow that up there.
Yeah. You can go home and tell your kids what you got called today.
That's right. Listen to it about 30 minutes in, guys. Tracy Hunt, Director of External Affairs.
And Sean Stephen with External Affairs.
So, going to hit on a few things, focusing first on carbon, and then Sean has a broader update. Going to talk a minute or so about some bills that didn't pass, a bill that's still alive, and then last time we reported on three categories of carbon-related bills, so I'm going to dig into that just a little bit. No decisions need to be made today. Obviously open for questions. So Friday was a big cutoff, and there are a number of bills that are technically dead, but we'll wait and see if they remain dead. One of them I'd like to point out is called the A4 bill, which is it had a lot of momentum, and there's a lot of interest, and essentially that created an ability for IOUs to get a rate of return on power contracts, which could be of benefit to them and us. And also, it created a $40 adder to carbon resource costs when IOUs compared resource alternatives. So if they had a resource that had a carbon content just in their planning, they would add $40 to that to compare that to a resource that didn't have a carbon content. So those are two important items that that were included in this A4 bill. And like I said, A4 means alternative form of regulation. So you might hear that. It is technically dead, but we'll see what happens. There also is a bill, 1144, that is still alive, which is the establishes new emission reduction targets for the state of Washington at 80% below 1990 levels, which, by the way, are the numbers that we used when we worked with PGP to perform that carbon reduction study that you've all seen. So last 2 weeks ago, I guess, three categories. One was the governor's carbon tax bill. I'm going to talk a little bit about that. Other legislation, such as an RPS and a clean energy standard, have an update on that. And then finally, the initiative. We were contemplating or anticipating the release of that. So first, with the carbon tax bill, governor's carbon tax was a $12 tax where utilities were able to retain 100% of that tax. And it included provisions or programs that recognize early adopters, such as Chelan PUD, for having clean energy. So there were opportunities back for Chelan County for that were from revenues that would have been created out of that bill. And essentially, they weren't able to get support for the bill, so the governor withdrew the bill, and the governor's carbon tax bill is now considered dead. Other legislation, though, is still in play, and the House and the Senate leadership, as well as the governor, have pivoted to their backup plan, which they've described as the 100% clean energy standard.
Tracy, can I interrupt for just a second? Can you tell me how close of a call it was on the governor's bill?
We don't have a vote count, but I think it was pretty close. There was two components to that. One is having enough to actually pass. I mean, obviously the Democrats were looking at most of their folks voting in favor of the bill, but they also, I think, were interested in having it in a bipartisan way, looking for Republicans also to provide some support. And I don't have a specific number, but the governor's calculus was they didn't have enough to get it out of the Senate.
But it was close.
Yeah, I think it was pretty close. So in there's a number of pieces of paper that I have included, and really just a high level. Yeah, that packet, there's, I think, what, six documents in there. And those documents are going to be in play for at least the next week, some of them for longer. But I'd like to, for this first one, if you go to the fourth item in there, it's this cost and emission impacts. It's a chart. The clean energy standard that is in play right now, just for quick reference, this chart describes kind of the cost and the cost and the emission reductions. And the governor's carbon tax, by way of reference, would have been $12 to $30 a ton. And our assessment performed by E3, and we confirmed this again this morning, that this clean energy standard is 100% clean energy standard, would move you along this line clear up here where we've assessed that a 95% clean energy standard would cost about $714 a ton. Compare that to the $12 to $30 a ton that was in the governor's carbon tax.
For practical purposes, what would $714 a ton mean to the price of a gallon of gas?
Well, at $12 a ton, it was approximately 10 cents a gallon. But I don't know if that would equate directly over, you know, I don't think you could scale it that way with gas. I don't know how that would.
I don't think we've done that analysis.
Yeah. We were looking.
It'd be expensive.
It'd be a much bigger number.
It'd be a bigger number. So because it's in play, we've also included some talking points about the 100% clean. Just so you're aware, if somebody asks, here's some more information. We don't need to get into that, but it's also, this is some issues with why that's a problem, at least for the utility sector. And then another big important thing that we do is provide reliable power. So I'd like to point out another attachment, which is a DOE letter that references this legislation and basically says, this is from Administrator Mainzer, that describes some concerns around reliability with moving to 100% clean energy and the interest of BPA to work with the state to assess that. So there's a lot of information in your packet around this. We see it as a significant issue. And so PGP, the PUD Association, is also working to create a substitute to replace the clean energy standard with what I've included in your packet is a study bill, essentially, and I've included the actual language of the bill. It's only four pages, better than some of these multi 10, 20, 100-page bills, and then a summary of that four-page. So we've got the clean energy standard that's in front of us right now, and then we're working with folks to get an alternative to that. It's very important this week. It's moving really fast. This is a lot of information, but I wanted you to have it in case you have any questions or if anybody asks you any questions. There's a lot moving with those things. I know you haven't had a chance to dig into it, so please, if you have any questions, let me know afterwards when you've had a chance to digest that a little bit. Also in play is now the initiative. The initiative was submitted to the Secretary of State. This last was Friday. Friday afternoon, and we are assessing the initiative. It's essentially a $15 tax, similar to the governor's carbon tax proposal. There's a great, you know, with any initiative, there's a lot of uncertainty. It doesn't go through the open process that other efforts. So there's a great deal left to rulemaking. Which would be a lot of involvement required if it were to pass, a lot of uncertainty there. There's a revenue oversight board So the money comes in, then it would get doled out through panels and boards. Neither of the panels or board categories have utility representation. And then Commerce would approve PUD investment plans. So we would have to develop an investment plan for any of the retained revenues. So, and it also does not include any of the programs that were in the governor's carbon tax bill for early adopters. So we are still assessing the impacts of it. It is a carbon tax. We will have more on that as we dig into and get some more questions answered. So quick summary. The governor's bill is out. There are several bills that are technically dead, but one or two might come back this week. The new emission reduction target bill is still in play, which is 80% below 1990 levels. And then initiative and or the other legislation we're trying to get replaced, the Clean Energy Standard, get that replaced with a carbon study bill. And you have the details of that. And then finally, we'll be digging into and assessing the implications of the initiative that is now going to be getting signatures in the state of Washington.
Tricia, I have a question. On the initiative, in terms of the terminology they're using, aren't they calling it a fee versus a tax? But in reality, it's a tax?
Right. there are a lot of discussions about how to term any of these things, calling something a tax or a fee or a penalty. But it all comes down to increasing the price of consuming carbon-related products in the state of Washington, and then creating a revenue source that then gets reallocated for specific uses.
So mandating a revenue source, especially if it's mandated through government, to me is a tax. But I understand.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it tastes better if you code it.
How much, Tracy, do we know about the initiative or the initial stages of it?
Before any work had been done on the initiative, the proponents of the initiative had sent out and done some polling information. And their polling information, testing out the use of the word tax or fee or clean, all were pretty positive for the polling results. And it gave them, I guess, partial justification to move ahead. That is, so that's where we are. They'd done some polling results. They crafted this legislation or this the initiative, and I would expect those numbers to change as now information becomes available and as people start to speak about what the initiative is from their perspective. Mm-hmm. We will see how that process moves forward.
Who are the primary sponsors of the initiative?
Did I bring the list? Climate Solutions. It's on the handout. Oh, it is on the handout. State Labor Council. Director of Front and Centered. Nature Conservancy. Washington Conservation Voters. Washington Environmental Council. Puget Sound Sage. Like I said, Climate Solutions. Got Green and One America.
Thank you. Never heard of those last two.
So we will keep you posted on what happens this week. Obviously, we won't have another board meeting, but we will be reporting back in a couple weeks. And if anything happens with this other legislation, specifically the Clean Energy Standard, and comparing that to the study bill, we'll keep you posted.
Tracy, is there any indication of what the appetite is from the public in terms of supporting an initiative?
The early results from the work that the proponents did showed it as when they tested those tax and clean and renewable, those terms, or how they would go about kind of capturing a carbon piece of regulation, were all positive. And the 60%+ category.
Any concept regionally of where the support's coming from? I mean, I could guess.
I don't know where they're polling.
Okay.
Yeah, how they perform those polls.
Right. Polling areas.
Yeah, I don't know.
But if it gets recharacterized as a 10-cent a gallon gas tax or 15-cent a gallon gas tax, those numbers would change probably.
I would expect as the debate becomes more public, and this is the good thing about having an open public process, you know, with the drafting of legislation, you get to have a lot of input, both sides. This has been created by one group of people, and it was made available in its final form Friday. So I imagine as more information gets out and people get their eyes on it to share their perspective of the impacts, those numbers would change.
Yeah. And Randy, I think that might be relative to the age and the location of the person. Again, you know, I think I made a comment a couple of weeks ago that when you look at South Lake Union, the apartments that are going up in that neighborhood will by far exceed the total population of Chelan, Douglas, and Okanagan counties. And they're by and large people who utilize public transportation, Uber, other. And in polling of those people, they really don't have much concern about the gas tax because it affects them in their rates, but they're perceive themselves as not the ones paying it. You know, so it's a little in the shadow of the Space Needle, you know, concept. So mm-hmm. That's why I was kind of asking.
That one is right under the Space Needle.
It's directly under it, yeah. Yeah, a year ago there were 14 cranes and went back a couple of weeks ago, and there are now 18 construction cranes in that neighborhood. So just more apartments, by and large.
I'd like to add two quick thoughts to this discussion. One, I think it has proven to be valuable to be engaged. We were able to, through some good work and Tracy's part and PGP to be able to get the ballot initiative sponsors to make some changes that we thought were important that certainly make it work, make the whole bill, if it were to be enacted, make it more workable and certainly would provide some benefit for Chelan County as well. Second thing on the study actually has an important goal in it, which, you know, we have been advocating for least cost approach to greenhouse gas emission reduction. The challenge that you have there is you have to define the goal, because if you say least cost approach, it's least cost approach to accomplish what? And if the folks were actually able to agree as to what the percentage reductions that the electric utility sector should be seeking to achieve, then you actually can use that work that we've done to be able to say, okay, then here are the choices that get you to that goal at the least cost. Both of these actually have some positive items in terms of moving things in a better place than where it would have been absent the discussion and the engagement, particularly of PGP and Chelan.
So ahead on the balance of the issues then beyond carbon, carbon and related issues have been dominating the subject for us in particular, various other issues we've been tracking, some energy related. And some related to HR, human resources, purchasing, et cetera. This week will be a focus on the supplemental budget. They're by design of the session, be working only on the budget, but these other issues are at play. Some of these other issues are necessary to implement the budget. But by the 8th, it's the end of the session, and there is an appetite to be done by the 8th. This is an election year. And the legislators cannot be raising money, can't be campaigning while they're in session. So they have a desire to be able to get out of session as soon as possible. So the rest of the week is supposed to be on the supplemental budget. Just a couple other energy-related, but not to the carbon. There was some distribution planning bills. There was changes to net metering. The one that was moving forward was the Senate Bill 6081. It is now... We say technically dead because they didn't clear their opposite house, the chamber, Saturday, but as Tracy alluded to, there's a lot of different issues at play, and if they can say some of these were necessary to implement the budget, they can bring these into a deal, if you will, at the end of the day. And that's what happened. Remember last year in one of the special sessions, there was a flurry of activity that brought bills forward. So the other one, distributed resource planning, 1233, was another one that Representative Morris pushed hard for the last few years. Got it through almost through the end of the process. It didn't make it through last Saturday. I'm going to jump into retail telecom. There was two bills related to this. The 6034 was the Kitsap PUD bill, Kitsap only bill to get retail internet authority for internet services. It actually is passed and is now on to the governor for his signature. It remained pretty much as we had seen it. It had gone through many changes over the course of the session, but came back to internet services only. They did add on an administrative law judge opportunity to dispute. There's a dispute over, is there adequate or no services available? If there's a dispute between Kitsap PUD and a service provider, they would use an administrative law judge to help with that dispute, settle that dispute. The other bill, the 5935, was the municipal bill. It is technically is still NTIB, necessary to implement the budget. So we'll have to wait and see what goes on with that. But the Kitsap portion that was in at one point, it was stripped out. So now it's pretty much just a municipal bill. And there's no connection to PUDs at all in that bill now. Electric vehicle incentives. Seattle City Light had a bill that they actually worked very hard on. We had participated in some of the early drafting. The number of that, 6187, had made it through some of the committees. There was actually a provision that was added on to it that could make it NTIB, but we'll see if it makes it through the process at this point. So it's, although it's somewhat considered dead because of this aspect that was added on late in the process, could still be a play. A couple of energy bills that early on that we were worried about conservation bills for the investor-owned utilities, on-bill repayment programs, the bills that would have impacted our SNAP program, all those died quite a while back. They completely died last Saturday. Then lastly, a handful of bills we'll call general government. The Voting Rights Act bill is on to the governor. There's a wage equality bill that's on to the governor. A bill related to job applicants and their arrest records that's on to the governor. There was a program for defaulting new employees to PERS 2. It is actually, it shouldn't be NTIB, so it didn't make it out of the Senate Ways and Means. There's a PERS 1 COLA. This would be now it started out as a 3%. Now it's down to a 2% one-time increase to PERS 2, but you limit it to $62.50 a month of an increase.
You said PERS 2, you meant PERS 1?
PERS 1, excuse me. Thank you. It's probably, it didn't make it out of committee or off the chamber, but it's probably considered NTIB. Prevailing wage, how they would calculate prevailing wages is on to the governor. A road worker safety bill, which would help with any workers that weren't covered under current law, it would help them. So it could include our staff as well working along the road. That's on to the governor. There was an assault of utility workers that has been at play for a number of years. It made it pretty far through the process and didn't clear chamber last Saturday, so it's dead. Some bills related to our utility billing transparency that seemed redundant to us as they were written, but it didn't make it out of bill, out of chamber. The things that were in there, we do already anyway here at Chelan County PUD. And finally, there was one that Waputo was watching. You may remember it was a work group to address natural disaster mitigation. Might have provided an opportunity for PUDs to be involved in this effort, but it didn't clear chamber, so it's now dead.
There was one not on your list that the governor just vetoed on
Records.
Public records.
Yes.
Would that have impacted us?
That bill was particularly strictly for the legislature and their public records, so would not have impacted us from ability of it didn't have a section to us, but strictly to the legislature. Anything else? So after Friday, we'll do one more this week in Olympia, and we'll send you a summary of all these bills at that point, too.
Super.
All right, thank you.
Comments, questions, anyone? Thank you, gentlemen.
All right, thanks.
Appreciate it.
Next up, we want to bring you what has been a series of updates regarding customer information system. Mark O'Brien is going to join us.
Hmm. Good morning, Commissioners. I'm Mark O'Brien, project manager for the Customer Information System. Today's agenda, we're going to go through, we're not going to be asking for any decisions from the board today, but we are planning to come back to the board either on March 19th or the following board meeting and look for approval of contracts and budgets to move forward with our CIS project. Today I'm here just to kind of review the background, kind of what we've been engaged in over the last year plus, current project status, look at our current estimates as the overall budget for this project, look at the schedule going forward, and open it up for some questions, and then identify those next steps. You know, one thing I would identify is so far we've had a lot of engagement with district staff in this process of developing all the requirements and contracts for this effort. In particular, my leads, Ken Smith from IT and his support staff, as well as Kerry Wendell, Megan McCarty. In addition, pretty large engagement with legal, with Karen Wiggum, as well as procurement, contracting, Mark Belton. So these have all been pretty key and dedicate a lot of time and effort to get us to this point in time. So I just want to acknowledge them, as well as the steering committee, which are executives here at the district, includes Steve Wright, Kelly Boyd, John Stoll, Mike Coleman, Eric Walquist. So that group also has been providing leadership and direction for this project through the duration through today. So a quick overview of the background. We put in our last CIS system back in 2004. It was purchased by Oracle, I think, in mid-2005. So shortly after we went live, that was purchased from Oracle. Support continued, but then ended in mid-June. And so we've been operating a system without official technical support for quite a while now. And so this has a higher risk profile for the district. And so it's been on the agenda to move this forward and get to a system that is supported going forward and provide another long-term solution for the district. Again, some key things our current system does not provide. It doesn't provide that level of customer service that our customers are looking for. The advanced two-way metering strategy going forward would need to be supported with a new system, as well as enhanced business intelligence data analytics. So again, these are things that the current system doesn't provide the level of capabilities that we're looking for. Looking over the past year and a half, going back to 2015 through the first part of 2016, the district developed a request for proposals. So this went through and identified all the requirements we were looking for. That effort was initiated back in December. We went to the board in December of 2015 to initiate that discussion. Came back in March 21st of 2016 and to further discuss that with the board. We then moved forward with issuing that RFP, that request for proposal, in third quarter of 2016. Again, came back to the board on July 18th, gave them an update of that process at that point in time. The following quarter, we evaluated those proposals that we received. We received 11 proposals. We identified and evaluated 9 of those proposals that met the district's goals and objectives. Again, came back to the board mid-December on December 21st of 2016 and gave the board an update at that point in time related to the overall project status. Moving into 2017, we limited or got our top 4 solution providers identified related to the CIS as well as meter data management system. And so we looked at the top 4 in each of those categories, had on-site interviews, discussions with those vendors in Q1. Moving into the mid part of 2017, we actually did a deliberate pause to further reevaluate proposal evaluations. And that included looking at the actual software solutions as well as implementation partners associated with each of those types of CIS systems. And so we really went back and looked at those requirements. Again, at that point in time, in association with the district's strategic planning process, we established a forecast of about $7 million, and that was submitted as part of the 2018-2022 business plan that was approved by the board last year and then was drove the budget for this year, 2018. Just to kind of pause and discuss that, really what we looked at when we had that pause in 2017, you know, just identifying the new characteristics of the district. Again, we are relatively small in customer size, but relatively large in the actual production and engagement we have and all the associated support systems that the district has. So we have a lot of other top-tier, high-level technical solutions that we have. And so, again, the CIS system ties and links into a lot of these systems. And so it's pretty critical that we have the right application to work with the other applications. Again, the and then during that discussion with the board back in August 21st of 2017, we had further discussions, asked for further direction. The district at that point in time concluded that we needed to maintain and support those other financial systems, internal control systems, and the associated functionality they provided, and really move toward a top-tier system. Again, our evaluations covered everything from a Tier 1, a Tier 2, and a Tier 3 type system. Generally, the customer base our size, you're looking more at a Tier 3, possibly a Tier 2. But again, with the caveats that we have other high-level, really complex systems that the district operates, primarily to support our large generation operations, the board decided that we want to maintain that superior level of you know, customer service and capabilities here at the district. Moving into Q4, we had the opportunity, we moved forward and we identified that Oracle CC&B or their CIS product was the preferred option. Shortly before that, they deployed a new system, a new deployment of their CIS, which they called C2M. So again, we had further evaluations to evaluate whether we wanted to go with their new deployment option. The advantage of that new deployment option was the inclusion of a meter data management system in addition to the CIS system. In addition, there was additional capabilities related to analytics, access to data within that deployment of C2M. The district at that point in time decided to move forward with the new deployment option. And I would note that we recently had a staff attend Oracle's user conference last week, and that was one of the themes that they kept hearing was how envious they were that they were not able to make that same decision that had recently put in their CC&B product, and they had missed that opportunity to go with this new deployment option. And so that's just reconfirmed, I think, the appropriate direction that the district decided.
What's CC&B again?
Customer care and billing. It's just that kind of name they applied to their customer information system. And so it actually, the C2M product includes the CC&B, the customer care and billing product, as well as an MDM, meter data management system application. So we consider that a pretty good win for the district to have that opportunity to bring those systems on fully integrated. And so we avoid a lot of work in the future and really sets the stage for our next phase related to advanced metering infrastructure and having that system in place to support that when we do move forward with that project. Q1, really the last few months here, we've been working with the vendors, implementers to finalize contract language and requirements, and we're nearing the finalization of that, those contracts, and hoping to come back to the board again in the next meeting and provide resolutions to accept those contracts. Moving forward, we would look at initiating the project mid-April, and this is a 16-month project before go-live, so we would be coming online, you know, toward the end of next summer. It'd be probably an August type of a go-live date that we would be targeting for 2019. And this is a common slide we've used in prior presentations just to kind of show the entire array of applications that are tied to the CIS and potentially will be added on. Again, we are focusing on the CIS component of this. I would identify that we are also including the meter management system as part of that new deployment option. Again, I would note that this is we have the capabilities. We will not have the functionality installed during this project, but it will give us the capability to move toward interval-related meter reading data with an AMI-type solution. And so it does set the stage for that. And so all the configurations and everything that we do will help support that effort going forward.
Is that an extra cost when that conversion is made?
When we bring in the AMI system, this will have an advantage of maybe reducing the cost of that particular project because it'll already have pre-established the MDM component. There will be additional cost associated with additional configurations at that point in time. There are some slight impacts to the cost of this project, bringing in additional capabilities, but not material impacts to our planned project. Does incrementally cost us a little bit more. It's a new deployment, a little more configuration and requirements, but it will avoid a lot of rework in the event when we do move forward with the AMI solution. And there are other applications that we plan to bring on following this project that would be more mobile work management, enhanced customer self-service, et cetera. So this sets the stage for bringing on those additional capabilities in the future for the district. Just a quick link to the current strategic plan for the district. The CIS project remains on schedule. Again, some of the key dates in that plan was to get a budget approval in March, finalize those contracts, get milestones established for 2018, and then initiate that project. I would also note that this is also supporting the Advanced Intelligent Grid Initiative by getting the capabilities for MDS established and actually enabling us the potential to start doing some R&D type work and prepare for that other project. Kind of give you a historical look of how the project has evolved. This project goes back again to 2015. At that point in time, the district identified that the system was out of date, not being supported, and we established an initial placeholder using some more generic expectations, about $2.5 to $4.5 million, and that would be looking at other utilities implementing systems that were associated with their size. So that would be more of a tier three type of a solution. And so we put a placeholder in the budget for 2016 and identified that we would start initiating some efforts to look at our requirements and evaluate systems going forward. Again, in Q3 of 2017, associated with the business planning process, we identified we were going to go with a tier one system, identified that the CC&B, the customer care and billing product from Oracle, was the preferred solution. At that point in time, we adjusted the forecast to $7 million, so that was included in the approved five-year strategic plan. But we also identified that we did not have a detailed work plan yet associated with that, and so we did not modify the budget, and we're waiting for final negotiations of contracts to determine what the actual project's scope and cost would be. Looking into March, currently, We identified we would go to the new C2M product, customer to meter product from Oracle. Again, that's a tier one application with MDMS capability. We are currently finalizing negotiations on contract terms and language. Currently, we're looking at an estimated budget of about $8 million. The next slide kind of goes into detail of the overall project cost, the components. You know, a large portion of this is district resources, but we do have external expenditures related to implementation contract. It's about $2.9 million. We're looking at associated, that's over an 18-month project schedule. About $0.7 million related to travel expense reimbursements to get them on site during the course of that 18 months. Actual software and licensing purchases with Oracle. About $0.7 million. And I would note, ongoing, there's a little over $100,000 additional licensing on an annual basis. And that would be a continuation similar to what we have today with our current products. We'll also be engaging with a third-party quality assurance independent consultant who will help monitor the project, keep the steering committee updated related to project status, and so we can remain on schedule. Overall, we got about $4.5 million that would be related to additional expenditures beyond district resources. In addition, district resource will be heavily involved in this project. Again, unlike other small utilities, once we put a system like this in, we take over ownership of it and operate it and maintain it. A lot of smaller utilities will continue to look at for third-party consultants to help maintain their systems on an ongoing basis. So we not only help get the system up and running, but we assume ownership. So there's a pretty heavy engagement from not only our customer service area, but our technology area as well to maintain the system. Overall, we're looking at, and that including contingencies in that overall project, we're looking at about $8 million for that project, and that would occur in through 2018 and 2019. I would note that the project budget that we're going to bring forth will not require any revisions to the 2018 budget, or will it change the current forecast, the longer-term forecast for the CIS project as well? I'm going to pause there just for a second. Any questions on kind of the summarized project budget? Kind of looking at the schedule going forward, again, we're hoping to come back on March 19th with formal resolutions to initiate those contracts. We'd be looking at getting mobilized mid-April, so April 16th. Kind of following spring break, we'll be getting implementation partner on site, again, getting the district resources up and running and kicking that project off. Project phases, the first 3 months of the project, 2 to 3 months, is really called the analysis phase. That's where we go through in detail and look at all the requirements and identify any holes that we had in our project plan or any gaps. And so that's really what we have contingencies for, because there's potentially items in there that we'll identify. Either we don't necessarily need to have in our project plan, or maybe things we need to add. And so that will occur through July. Then we initiate actual building, configuring the actual system. And so that occurs through the duration of 2018 and into 19. Again, overlapping that effort is ongoing testing. So as we build and identify interfaces, enhancements, configurations, there's a series of continual testing of that, of all those different components. Again, we're looking at final acceptance and looking at go live end of July, first part of August. I think we currently have identified August 2nd through the 5th, the weekend, to actually do all of the formal go live efforts. Yeah, and that's preceded by at least 3 mock tests. And so we go through and we run through the entire process. And everything needs to occur over a weekend. And so we need to replace things out, install, transfer data. At some point in time, at that exact point in time. And so you have to spend a lot of time rehearsing that to get it within that window. And again, just to reiterate, future phases, again, those are not included in this project scope, but that would be additional features that we would look to leverage with this technology, as well as just the ongoing updates and maintenance of that system. So with that, I'd open up for any questions or comments.
Fellow commissioners? Yeah, Randy.
You know, when we see this presentation, I'm reminded how our entire society has changed and the requirements and needs have changed over a very short time span. I love to tell the story when I was in high school that we were then experimenting with electric typewriters. And and today you will pry my iPhone out of my dead cold hands. Yeah. And this iPhone wasn't around the last time we went through a technology revision here at the district. So a recognition of the needs of organizations such as ours to be on that cutting edge to prepare for a future that we don't know what it's going to look like in 10 years is really, really important. And so I'm much, much appreciative of the due diligence that that you guys have gone through. Recognize there's a price tag, but as that plays out, what we gain from that price tag could be an incredible asset going into the future. And so thanks for all your hard work and due diligence in going through this evaluation process.
Thank you.
If there are no other questions, Mark, kind of what is, and it's just exactly what Commissioner Smith was talking about, What is the anticipated half-life of this project? I mean,
well, you know,
which is a little like asking how long is a piece of string. I understand that. But.
You know, I think we've been looking for probably similar life or longer than our current system. Again, we got that back in 04, so it's served us well. Again, there'll be upgrades and updates to this base application, but we would like to think that would be around for quite a while. Again, Oracle has provided us kind of their roadmap going forward, and they're actually incorporating more features under the C2M deployment option going forward. And so they're, instead of selling these individual systems that you then have to tie together with interfaces, they're putting it under one package deal. They're really targeting the smaller utilities that you know, weren't unable to buy all the standalone systems and bring them together. And so I think it's good news for the district. This deployment option in particular, I think the longevity of it will be pretty good. Whereas people that just installed, say, the CC&V application and their MDM in two different environments, they're going to have to rewrite the whole process when they do transition. So I think we're at the advantaged position at this point in time.
Okay. So along that same line, what is the level of flexibility, adaptability? Would it require revitalization at times of the whole unit or segments of the unit, or is it not segmented? I mean, I understand it's more of a comprehensive, but so when there needs to be an update, I guess the larger the update, the larger the piece, the higher the cost. So kind of where are we in terms of flexibility, adaptability?
Yeah, what I would add is the natures of the Tier 1 applications, like the one we're purchasing, have extensive configuration capabilities, and that's what makes them a top-tier system. That they're built and configurable to almost any situation.
Okay.
So that's why, and they're driven by large utilities that have a lot more complexity, and so they're always going to be probably well in advance of our requirements. But that's one of the advantages of a Tier 1 system, is it enables that configuration flexibility going forward. Unlike, I mean, more straightforward system that's just doing, you know, some straightforward processing and limits the configurations. So that, I would say, it puts us in a really good position in that light.
Okay. Other thoughts, questions?
Just a couple thoughts going off what Randy said. Go to all this effort, and then that just becomes the standard, and everybody, okay, now what's next? You know, it's not a big deal, yet it's a big deal for us. And so congratulations on the hard work. Two, and it was Oracle that bought PeopleSoft.
Correct.
And then just decided not to give any more support to that, so that was a good move on their part, well calculated. I'm sure. That was it.
Yeah. So,
Commissioner, I'd like to just jump in. John Stoll, Managing Director of Customer Utilities. I'd like to acknowledge Mark's leadership working through this. This has been a very, very dynamic, lots of hours, lots of work, and Mark and his professionalism and background has really helped lead the team that he's mentioned. So appreciate that. And I also want to just mention too, Commissioner Bowles, back to your comment. Back when we put in the PeopleSoft system, we went through a pretty concerted effort to have us fit the software to as much as possible. We didn't customize a lot.
Right.
And that served us well, and that's why we were able to, I think, kind of extend the life of that system. But I think that's a key piece going forward, too. We want to maintain that philosophy. So when we do have those upgrades, they're hopefully as smooth as possible.
Well, you know, it's anything in this arena is there's going to be some obsolescence by the time it's installed. And so then, you know, what is the flexibility in terms of curing that piece without addressing the whole? Because that's just the nature of the beast. You can't put it in fast enough to stay current, you know. So there has to be a way to approach that. And I like the idea of the configuration capability that opens up a lot of opportunity, differentiated from I think our current system, which was more modular based.
What I would end with is just in preparation for the next board meeting. We're looking to bring back a resolution that will combine the software purchase from Oracle as well as the implementation contract. Those are both associated with the RFP that we did back in 16, was 16-42. So those will be brought back as a resolution. In addition, we'll be initiating kind of additional task authorization through our independent quality assurance efforts. And the overarching budget revision, again, noting there would be no change in the 2018 budget or the long-term forecast. So it's really just formalizing that budget going forward. So any other additional questions?
And you're okay with where we are?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you. Appreciate it very much, thank Mark. You. Appreciate the efforts. And now for the management of large loads requirements.
Next one I'm going to take, because this is an effort that's across the entire district in terms of the work impact. Rebecca's going to help me with getting some things up on the screen there. So, first of all, we are increasingly having the potential impact of this dawn on us. So we're looking at the idea of adding 100 to 200 megawatts of retail load. We don't know whether that will happen or not, but we have to take it seriously as if it might happen. And that significantly changes our portfolio in terms of how we sell power and has reverberations throughout the organization, both in terms of revenue consequences as well as construction and all of the associated activities like contracting and bids and those kinds of things that need to be done. So we're going to talk a little bit about the way that we are structuring ourselves to be able to manage this workload, some of the support that we're trying to get, bringing in some folks from the outside to help us, the potential impacts to the 2018 District Performance Plan, and I want to emphasize potential because we're going to be going through an effort over the course of the next month or so to try to understand how much of that 100 to 200 megawatts is real, and it turns out it's not real, then the impacts may not be as severe as are described here. On the other hand, if it is all real, the impacts could be more severe than what is described here. A little bit about the outreach efforts that we have going on to get to particularly the other governmental entities in the county and talk with them about the potential impacts, and then where we go in terms of next steps. So let's start for taking a look at how we're structuring the team that's working on this. We have, of course, our general structure of all the managing directors who are involved in this. And I want you to just pause for a moment and think about, again, the magnitude of the impact here that an awful lot of the team is heavily involved. So there are generation and transmission impacts in terms of, so how would we provide power? Particularly the transmission component, how would we make sure that we have adequate transmission if we significantly change the retail load here. It will have impacts in terms of transmission construction that would be necessary. We're looking at distribution impacts, so probably going to need more substations and the associated interconnections that would occur with that. If we're selling more power, we're going to have contracts that are going to have to define the terms of the energy supply. We talked before about four different types of energy supply options that we would develop, everything from our current high-density load to something that looks like an Alcoa Puget-type contract to something that looks like a current slice-type contract all the way to facilitating a purchase from the market. There are reasons why we would want to consider that full range because if you're talking about adding 100 to 200 megawatts, we have a pretty well-defined risk profile today. And that risk profile spreads those megawatts across a lot of different types of sales and addresses risks like outage and stream flow and market price risk. So part of the reason for thinking about different types of contracts is we'd like to at least try to mimic, to some extent, the risk profile that we have today if we're switching into more retail sales, certainly at least to create options for customers that would potentially be beneficial for us in terms of managing risk. But that takes a lot of effort to try to think through those different types of contracts that we might offer. We've got a whole engagement in terms of the financial office, trying to think through rates, revenue requirements, how you develop cost of service analysis, pricing options. District services, of course, provides support across the district from contracts, management efforts, and all of the things that are necessary there. And almost everything, of course, runs through our general counsel's office, because at the end of the day, we're going to have a lot of contractual efforts, contractual requirements that will be put in place. So the structure that we have put in place is taking all of those groups and creating a lead within the organization. Lindsay is leading that effort for us in terms of the internal team, and she has a dotted line relationship now to the general manager because of the importance of this effort, so that we're connecting all the different pieces, because, again, we've got a lot of different parts of our organization that are engaged here. You can see the members of the team that are working with her, and then, of course, they are connected to subject matter experts throughout the organization. Hopefully that gives you a sense, again, of the magnitude of the work and why, when we're going to walk through in a moment the potential impacts to our organization, why it's so widespread and why there's so much risk to the district performance plan associated with this work.
Steve, before we go on, and it's it was a question I was going to ask, because the slide that has the team structure is a little bit different than the one that we're looking at on the screen. So my question was going to be, why is the managing director of district services, you know, on the same line, you know, as you? But then when I look at the one up here, it's not. So it's just a matter of trying to get it onto the page. Okay.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. That was it. So it, to me, it was kind of like, so this appears to be strategic, but that those two are different. So, but I don't know if anyone else was confused by that, but it it's helpful to see both. Thank you.
We are looking at bringing in some contract support. We've defined that in four key areas at the moment, and contracts are being developed to help us put this in place. The first is interconnection agreements. We haven't had larger than 5 average megawatt loads here before. So there's a whole set of policies associated with putting in place interconnection agreements that is a skill set that we could use some help on. We've identified some folks out there in the consulting world who have extensive experience in this area, and so we've already had some conversation with them and found them to be helpful in terms of helping us think through just the types of issues we need to make sure that we address. We need some work in terms of project management. Again, you got so many people working on so much stuff. Just defining critical path work is difficult for us right now, so someone that can put that together and help us think through the questions associated with what needs to go first and what's contingent upon what other pieces is something that we need. And we were already fully loaded in terms of our project managers across the district for the work that we had were contemplating. We're going to move into some new types of issues associated with rates. We described before the thinking through things like marginal cost pricing for transmission and distribution, choosing different pathways for that. We're going to want to make sure that we're really solid in that regard, because we know it's a big issue for the board and the community to make sure that we can be confident in describing what the financial impacts on the utility will be, and to make sure that we are minimizing impacts to existing customers. And we're also looking at some support in the transmission area. Transmission may turn out to be one of the more challenging pieces here, because we're looking at significantly large increases in load, which may incur in different locations across the district. And transmission analysis is very difficult to do to begin with. And then you put on top of that, well, you might be in location A, or you might be in location B, or maybe location A will go forward and B will, but then you have to also consider whether if A and B both go forward. And we have 7 different requests, and so you can think through the matrices of potential studies that could be done here. So we're trying to triage that and think through how we can provide meaningful information to the applicants, and at the same time try to make sure that we have adequately addressed what the construction impacts will be, both from the impact of siting, licensing, and then ultimately cost. How much will it cost to be able to put these kinds of different options in place? So that's the contract support. As we've begun to think through impact of the district performance plan, that's really helpful to have a district performance plan, because we know the work that we're planning to do, and then we can walk through and say, okay, so what places in the organization are we likely to impact and what become lower priorities. We had planned to bring forward to you authority for a long-term hedge. Recall that we have existing authority, and we signed the Avista contract last year under that existing authority. But we have been thinking about 2027, 2028, when the Alcoa contract runs out, 2031, when the Puget contract runs out. May seem like a long way away, but for us, not really, because we think in decades here. So we're already thinking through what kind of authority should we get to be able to enter into 20-year type contracts and make sure that we're all together on that. We were pretty far along in that effort. Candidly, we're probably 80% of the way there. But given that we've got this potential for a large amount of retail load coming forward and the work that needs to go into that, we've decided to mothball that for now. So we will not complete that effort, and we will be red on that because we won't get it done in Q1 as was in the district performance plan. We had planned to do a fair amount of work on continuing our efforts to try to develop quantifiable attributes for capital programs so that we could rank capital programs. We do that somewhat quantitatively and a lot qualitatively today. We're trying to advance that in terms of being able to understand all the different capital projects we have here and be able to then draw lines about here's how much we're willing to spend, and therefore here's what falls below the line. That will likely be delayed. We're working on, you may recall, we did a presentation for you last year looking at the risk associated with wildfires, particularly to the transmission system. And we are planning to move forward with focusing on the area that we identified as the highest risk, which was the Chelan-Manson transmission line. We likely will need to delay that effort to start identifying what actions we take to protect the Chelan-Manson line. We're going to have some individuals in particular who are likely going to be heavily stretched, and we have a goal that everyone accomplishes their individual development plan goal for the year. We're thinking about creating, for at least some individuals, the ability to be able to not complete their IDP goal if necessary in order to be able to get some of this other work done. There, in a number of areas, we have advancement of the asset management program. Number one key one that we're worried about right now is the transmission asset management program. Again, we're going to be heavily stretched in transmission because of the need to do these various transmission studies and then translate that into costs and the whole set of activities associated with potentially with construction. We've got some work that we were planning to do to try to improve the bid workflow system for purchasing and contract management. So we do have bottlenecks in the organization. Purchasing and contract management tends to be one of them. We try to move a lot of contracts through, and we're already planning to do more than the average amount of contracts this year because we were planning to have our biggest share of capital. So this was one of our efforts to try to streamline that process, but it takes upfront work to get the benefits at the back end. And we're going to be struggling with trying to be able to find the time to do upfront work. We've got some work we've been trying to get done. Candidly, we had it in our work plan last year and had difficulty finishing it with respect to standardization of project management processes. This is something that we've been generally making progress on for the last 3-4 years to try to get real clarity around the project management processes that we use around here. Again, probably going to struggle with that because we're really pushing our project managers right now. The next one we're not clear on yet. We've got three significant substations we're working on, Ome, Leavenworth, and Chelan. We are thinking about possibly a different approach even to the way that we go at this. There's some new contracting processes that the state has offered up that where you put more time in to define the specs, but then you're able to turn it over to a contracting agent to be able to do the work. So Grant County PUD has used this and found it to be successful in terms of being able to streamline the timeline for projects, not necessarily the workload, I will tell you, but streamline timelines. And so we're going to be taking a look at that to see whether that's an option that might be available for us. We've got every year we take another bite at the apple on business continuity, where we try to improve our business continuity practices to be prepared for the really difficult event. This year, we're looking at a district-wide exercise to try out our business continuity practices. We're going to have to take a look at that and see whether that's something that we choose to delay for a year. We've got customer utilities asset management, very similar to the transmission asset management I described before. And then it might seem like a stretch, but it's really not. Fiber expansion premises passed is contingent upon the make-ready work for our distribution lines. And so if we are stretching with respect to distribution activities, then it can potentially spill over into the fiber program and the fiber build-out. So let me just be clear. We are not saying today absolutely every one of these things is going to miss. We are going through and saying, what are the ones that are more likely to miss than not? And these would be on the list. And I also want to reiterate, there may be other things beyond what's on this list as we get further into this and better understand the workload impacts. So, again, it stretches throughout the whole organization. Oops, I thought I was done and I wasn't. Seemed like a lot already. In terms of impacts in the marketing program, we were planning to do work on looking at the energy imbalance market. Recall that we've made decisions in the past not to participate in the energy imbalance market. That continues to evolve, so we're going to take another look at that this year to see whether we should be engaging. We were looking at developing a product because we've got all of this solar coming on, particularly in the West. Is there a product we could develop that would specifically help to balance solar? And we would think could potentially be very attractive in the California market. Long-term marketing plan, again, trying to think through where it is that we want to sell to. The customer diversification project, which is really around, believe it or not, was around how do we want to balance retail loads with wholesale loads? And why might we be interested in attracting more retail loads? We're going to get to actually do that in the real world as opposed to practicing it. So let me just pause there and say, any questions about that before we go to our outreach efforts? Okay.
I will comment and say that is a very deep reach into our annual process in terms of disruption. Potential disruption, and that concerns me and all of us.
It's hard, to tell you the truth, to put a lot of thought into planning and thinking about where we're going to go and then see the potential impacts from all of these. On the other hand, I'll just go back to the last point, was we were thinking through the question of, with low wholesale prices, should we be doing more in the retail area? And so we're going to, it turns out, advance that one a lot quicker than we were thinking we were going to, at least in terms of understanding. Now, whether we actually end up with this amount of retail load is another question. We've had a lot of outreach activity, Eric, John, and their groups, in terms of meeting with municipal governments and the county over the course of the last few weeks. That has been around the whole concept of impacts potentially on other things that they want to do. They've got economic development activities they want to pursue. As we use up capacity on our system, then it creates some exposure to them for their own plans. So they've been very interested in what's going on. Certainly there has also been concern because of the issues associated with public health and safety around high-density load use, where it's invisible to us, and the potential consequences from that. So in the last couple of weeks, the city of Wenatchee has adopted interim controls in terms of limiting the amount of high-density load that they will permit in their service territories. City of Chelan has also adopted a moratorium. The city of Wenatchee interim controls actually places a workload back on us. So they're asking us to be able to assess what the impacts to capacity would be of HDL loads coming in, which are the same kinds of studies that we're already talking about, the transmission distribution studies, et cetera. Hopefully we can match those up in terms of the work that we're planning to do with the requests that they have. But if they were to come in and ask for things beyond what we were already planning to do, then it leads to the workload problem. with that, I'd just say next steps, we're getting the management structure in place. I'd say it already is in place. We're getting the consultants on board. We hope to have that done by the end of this week. We're up in the game in terms of outreach to the large load requesters. Candidly, I thought we would hear more after the presentation at the last board meeting, where they would begin to see the pricing and would have more questions. We haven't heard as much from them in the last couple of weeks, so we're going to outreach to them. And want to make sure you know this is the direction we're going. If that changes your plans, and particularly if it changes your plans in a way where you're no longer interested, we'd rather know sooner than later. So we want to engage with you and tell us what you're thinking. We'll certainly have more engagement with other municipal entities and county governments as they're thinking through codes and ordinances. And we'll be getting back with you as this continues to evolve.
Commissioners, thoughts, comments, questions? Public? Okay.
I just have one thought.
Please.
I appreciated in the communication document that we got in the email, the article on the unintended consequences, the opposite effect of economic development. That really gave me some, that was an interesting article. So I just appreciate that being shared.
A very similar situation with Messina.
You're talking about the New York Times article.
Yeah.
Very interesting article.
Yeah, because it's very similar to, you know, well, there's probably not a closer one to a certain extent than where we are.
Well, we're pretty close with New York Power Authority, actually. Mm-hmm. They help us on things that they've been out in front on, and we help them. And so we've been sharing a lot of information with them about it. The high-density load rate that was put in place here, and they're looking at that pretty carefully.
Yeah, and I don't know if now's the time to ask it or not, but we had in our last meeting 2 weeks ago, I had asked the question in terms of where we are as far as capacity. And so I don't know if that's something that's answerable now or later this afternoon or not ready yet.
Not ready yet. Okay. So we've got that in our follow-up list.
Okay.
And then put that in the not ready yet list. We've done a fair amount of work because we were thinking about the long-term hedge. Done a fair amount of work there, but we need to do some more in terms of understanding this as a retail load.
Yeah. Okay. So, anything else from any other commissioner?
If Janet Jaspers was here, I'd say good luck, Lindsay and Janet.
Yeah.
I'll pass it along.
I was just going to ask. Lindsay, is probably not a fair question, but so how does it feel to have that dotted line?
Lindsay and I are talking.
Yeah, she's well represented. Okay. Any other thoughts? Anything? All right. Thank you very much. John, Lindsay, but just to the staff, thank you all. Okay, so we're quarter tell, and is there anything you want to pick off this afternoon?
I would like to, if I could, maybe invite John up. He's got a couple of issues, Chelan community meeting coming up. Chef.
I have two, actually. So the first one is just a brief update on the Peshaston project, the treatment plant. We've got confirmation from Ecology that the grant funding is fully approved and endorsed, so a little over $2 million, which we were waiting for to kind of make the final next step with the project itself. So we have an agency goal right now to have the project advertised and bid in quarter two. So far, so good. I know Ecology has been reviewing our plans that have been submitted. Hopefully without any holdups there, we're ready to take the next step. So, again, we're moving forward.
Can't tell you how happy that makes me. I don't know when it started, at least in my opportunity to be a commissioner, but it's been a long time. It's just kind of one of those that's had its own life.
Yeah, it's
you guys have been really patient in pursuing that, and it'll be nice to bring that one around.
Ron Slabaugh has been marking his career by it.
So. I think so. Yeah, very good.
No, he's been very active. And
by the way, the Pechastin sewer was the genesis of the Tri Commission.
Yeah, yeah.
Which went back, and I see Jeff Smith back there. Jeff was involved with Keith Gaynor and J.C. Yep. Baldwin and I when we sat down and started talking sewer with Joyce Stewart.
The next topic I wanted to touch on is a request from primarily the city of Chelan and the mayor to come up and have another community discussion around advanced metering. I know in their council meetings they've had conversation, I think, from some folks who showed up and presented information. That coupled with, I think there's several new council members who probably weren't engaged in the conversation we had last April and May. So it's an opportunity to go up and, again, just present information. So I've been partnering with Suzanne Hartman and the mayor and putting together an agenda. Again, we're going to meet at the next Wednesday at 5:30 at the fire hall. And kind of similar to the substation, instead of, last time it was our board up there, it will be the city. Again, our whole approach is to share the information we presented and give them as much information and let them ask as whatever questions they have and hopefully make that a learning event.
Yeah, on that, I'm sorry, Gary, it's just kind of a mechanical thing. That's also the Wednesday that the next state association meets, so that involves commissioners. I'm wondering if we want to split commissioners, some to stay home, some to go, and then those then maybe all come together sometime Thursday at Olympia, or how do we want to manage this, because I think it's important. Or I guess I need to ask staff the importance of commissioners being there. Your thoughts?
The support is always well received. Primarily, though, I think we were responding to the mayor and his request to communicate to the council and the community there.
Yeah, I don't expect the mayor of Chelan to be aware of Wapuda's schedule, so I get that. But I'm looking for a way that we could provide coverage maybe in two areas. So I guess, commissioners, what are your thoughts?
Well, just an idea. I have all the confidence in the world of staff to be up there, and we would be just present. I think folks up there are getting used to commissioners being at least present and listening, and I would think at least one of us should be there to just to listen and be a representative from the board. I would certainly be willing to do that. Works better for my schedule.
Okay.
We will be recording it as well, or videotaping it for future.
And I do know I need to be in Olympia on the Wednesday as a state officer. So
I have a previous meeting I've already set up in Olympia.
Okay. Commissioner Congdon, what would be your desire related to the meeting in Chelan and Wapuda at the same time? Okay. So, Steve, you could be there for sure. Let me talk with Commissioner Congdon and find out related to her schedule. Two for sure will be in Olympia. We'll figure it out and get back to you, but I do think it would be important for us to be represented.
Commissioner Suzanne Hartman, Manager of Communications, would you like for us to look at another date and offer it to the mayor?
I think if we can cover it, let's move forward. If not, I think we're going to have a situation that just keeps rolling forward.
All right.
Yeah, because trying to find space in our five calendars is sometimes the most difficult task we have. Let us kind of maybe resolve that and just stay with the date and go forward.
Okay.
That seems to be acceptable.
I asked mainly because we plan to send a postcard out to all of Manson and Chelan customers probably tomorrow. So if we were going to change, we could still do that.
Yeah. Let's not.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's very helpful. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Very nicely done, by the way, Suzanne.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, like that.
Yep.
Bad hunt.
So is this a new meter on here? Just check. Okay. Any other items? We have about 8-9 minutes.
Unless you want to do commission, we have one other manager item, but we don't have the right staff here for it. So. Unless you want to do commission items.
Do we have commission items?
Don't believe I have any.
We can talk about DC.
We could. Commissioner McKenna, anything?
I just had a great time at our safety meetings, dropping in and saying hello and bringing, Gary did a great job bringing coffee and rolls and I learned a lot. It was a great experience, so appreciated that opportunity.
And I will second Commissioner McKenna's comments. It was a wonderful opportunity, and feedback that I've received was it was appreciated that just be able to see the commissioner, and that we don't levitate when we walk. We walk on the ground, both feet hit the surface, and that's. I know we can make fun of that, but I think sometimes that's the impression. And so it's nice to get out there and to show that we're all human too. So it went really well.
You know, I think I came away with, so I can bring this in as kind of the new person. I can't keep playing that card very much longer, but.
Hey, that's my line.
You know, the staff that came up and visited with me afterwards, just reinforce that this is an important in the culture of the Chelan PUD to be focused on safety, working as teams, taking personal responsibility, and looking at the data to see if it truly is making any difference. And I was just reminded that if you look at the research on implementation of anything, whether it's in the medical field, the education field, any field, when you implement a new strategy, typically there's a decline in performance. And if you're seeing level or a little increase in performance, you're really doing better than most. But my takeaway was this was that the employees appreciated this team effort, the personal effort, and the focus on improving, and it made their life and their work at the PUD that much better. And it was a great learning experience for me.
Okay, thank you. I think there's probably enough. By the way, I was going to comment if Commissioner Arsenault brought coffee and rolls, it was probably Starbucks.
It was.
How did we know that? What a thing. So I'd like to talk just a little bit about last week in Washington, D.C. with the American Public Power Association and the annual meeting that takes place where we have a chance to meet with our congressional delegates. Felt overall it went well. It was well organized. Schedules got shifted pretty significantly with the passing of Billy Graham and his internment at the and comments by the president at the Capitol that changed a lot of schedules and a lot of flexibility in the community because a lot of people were there from outside the community that changed traffic patterns, etc. Staff did a great job from the State Association at adjusting calendars, and we still got to everyone that we had intended to get to. I felt people were well prepared, both on the giving and receiving. You know, I think one of the better things is to always ask that question, what's on their mind? and you do get some feedback related to that. But from my perspective, I think it's kind of like a school levy or bond. You pass that every day. You just don't pass it the day the vote is taken. And so there's tremendous work done by the state association, by our general managers, by our legislative liaisons, our lobbyists, to continue to educate and to help our congressional people be aware of what our issues are. And, you know, we truly are a nonpartisan organization, and I think we really get treated in a nonpartisan way when we show up in those offices. We're not looked upon as a political entity as much as we are looked upon as organizations that provide a public service, and there's a real willingness on the part of those people to support what it is we do, and I think it's always good to refresh that relationship. But I would say overall, good communications. There's always moments that are intense and interesting, and some great exchanges take place. But yeah, it's a welcome event, and thanks for everyone's preparation, you know, over time, and including that time for maintaining those relationships. They are absolutely invaluable to us and to our ratepayers. Those are some of my thoughts. Okay. So I've got another 2 minutes if you want me to. Just kidding. Any other thoughts before we break for lunch?
Okay.
We're adjourned, or not adjourned, but recess for lunch, and we'll be back at 1. Good afternoon, and welcome to regular commission meeting of Chelan County Public Utility District, March 5, 2018. We had a morning session, which was a study session. Excuse me. So we're at the afternoon session, our business session, and four commissioners are present, and our fifth commissioner, Ann, is on the line, so we're all five here. And we're going to start with the public comment related to the residents of Eagle Creek Road, and we'll take care of that, and then we'll move on to our consent agenda following that. So I'm going to ask our general manager, Steve Wright, to speak to the issue first, and then we'll go from there. And thank you for being here. You're welcome. And when you speak, please, and I'm assuming you will want to, please use the handheld microphone, first and last name, and your address, because our meetings are recorded, and that gives the public and the media a chance to access that. So with that, we'll move ahead. And General Manager Steve Wright.
Well, I think, first of all, it's we love being in the public sector, and the reason we love that is because we serve the public. And this is an opportunity to hear from an interested group of folks who would like service from the PUD, and a service that we think is really valuable. The board has already chosen to get back into the business of expanding the fiber system, and we're trying to move from a little less than 70% to about 85 to 90% of the county that will be covered over the course of 10 years. And the challenge always is who goes first in that. And we've been working through a variety of issues, thinking that through in terms of where can we get the most bang for our buck, and in terms of getting as many people as possible availability of fiber. We've heard from this community. I'll just say that I know that Mike Coleman has been out and visited with this group, head of our fiber group. And I would just want to assure the commission and those folks who are here that their voices are being heard, that we understand their interests and are trying to figure out how we can address that and accommodate that within the context of, we have many folks across the county who are obviously very interested in receiving fiber, and trying to figure out how we do that in the most equitable way, possible. So with that, I would certainly welcome public comment, because this is it's always helpful to us in terms of thinking through the issues that we need to address, and in terms of establishing priorities.
Uh, Thank you very much. I'd like to just express our gratitude for the opportunity to be able to come.
Kevin, can you state your name and your address for
Kevin,
the
record? Kevin Powers. I live at 9003 Eagle Creek Road. It's approximately 4.2 miles up Eagle Creek Road in Leavenworth. We're a small group here today representing a much larger group, and I would like to let you know that we've got 134 resident homeowners on Eagle Creek Road that have been a part of this process. We had a significant number of individuals that had hoped to attend today and had expressed a desire to come and speak to the commission, but there were some insurmountable obstacles for them to get here on a Monday afternoon at 1 o'clock. So those people have asked that we speak on their behalf today. So we're going to be providing you with some information, and there's some other folks that are here with us today that we'll also be sharing. Maybe to start out with, maybe we could just introduce the people that are here and have them stand up and share their name and your address, obviously, and then where you are on Eagle Creek Road in terms of mile marker. Yeah,
and Kevin, please make sure that they have the microphone so it will be picked up on the recording.
My name is Rosemary Knapp, and I'm at 9425 Eagle Creek Road, 3.2 miles up Eagle Creek Road.
Paul Hedin, also at 9425 Eagle Creek Road.
Betsy Steele, I live about 3.5 miles up Eagle Creek Road, 9348.
Alex Steele, I live at 9348.
I'm Sue Osborne. I live at 11207 Eagle Creek Road, which is less than a mile up Eagle Creek.
My name is Linda Surratt. I live at 10897 Eagle Creek Road, which is about 1.25 miles up from Chumstick.
Mike Cushman and my wife Mary, we're at 10210 Eagle Creek Road. It's about 2 2/10 miles up from Chumstick.
Basically, we're here today for the following purpose. We have four items that we wish to present to the commission. An outcome that we're looking for, which is basically to bring high-speed fiber optic internet service to all the residences that are located on Eagle Creek Road in Leavenworth. Two, we're requesting that the PUD reconsider adding Eagle Creek Road into the initial PPB fiber build-out footprint and plans. Three, we're requesting inclusion in periodic reviews relative to future planning activities and the communication processes that are associated with internet build-out. And four, we were hoping to develop a working partnership with the PUD and as customer owners, basically to advocate for high-speed internet services in rural Chelan County and specifically for Eagle Creek Road. I'm going to provide just a real brief background for you in terms of how we came together, and then I'm going to turn it over to Betsy Steele, who's going to provide a little bit more history for you. We initially came together at a Chelan County Public Works meeting that was held in Leavenworth to learn about the completion of Phase 2 of road improvements that are scheduled for May and June of this year on Eagle Creek Road. The primary question at that meeting that was directed at Keith Gaynor was related to the county's plans for including fiber optic, both in terms of conduit and line work during that construction phase. We were informed at the meeting by Mr. Gaynor that we needed to talk with the PUD, but they had no plans to include any of that work as part of the Phase 2 project. As a result, a small group of us came together to reach out to Commissioners Steve McKenna and Randy Smith, which resulted in the PUD holding a public meeting specific to the questions and the needs of the Eagle Creek residents. As a result of the meeting, we covered a lot of territory. We got a lot of information that we hadn't heard before, and basically came away creating a synopsis of the meeting, which includes a brief history of how we initially came together, which I'm going to provide to each of you here at the close of the meeting. there were a couple of customer owners that have requested an opportunity to speak with you, and at this point I'd like to turn it over to Betsy Steele to provide you with some additional history and some details. Betsy?
I'm sure you're very familiar with the history of the fiber in our area. I'm not sure that everyone here is, though, so I thought I'd just review a couple things that have happened over the years. It's been about 8 years now since the PUD initiated its public power benefit program that aims, as you mentioned, for the 85 to 90% high-speed build-out with a cost ceiling of about $25 million. This, after the PUD had already spent close to $200 million, is that right, in previous years, on the program that was pretty controversial. Our utility decided not to accept a federal grant of, ironically, $25 million, for which they would have provided about $8 million in matching funds. So a great deal of money was already spent before the PPB program even started. We sort of have a sense that the pendulum maybe has swung the opposite way and being much more cautious about expanding fiber, and that in part has resulted in some areas being left out, others not, that sort of thing. We understand that the commissioners required cost efficiency, which has meant coordinating utility line work and upgrades with the high-speed internet installation. We Eagle Creek Road residents were indisputably told that we'd be included in that installation when the county's road improvement project, Phase 1, was begun in 2007. Therefore, it was truly astounding to discover that our road was not even on the PUD's radar screen within the PPB regions. 8,000 feet of conduit has been in place now for 7 years. And we are, quote, viable for inclusion into the PPGB, Mr. Coleman told us at the meeting. Yet once again, we were left out when new build-out was being considered in 2017. And now that Phase 2 of the Eagle Creek Road Project is set for this spring, we were anticipating the PUD and county could perhaps coordinate conduit installation. But as Kevin noted, that hasn't happened, despite it making a lot of sense, as County Commissioner Rick Gaynor said at the meeting last month. Did the fact that we had DSL installed by Frontier Communications in 2011 factor into that displacement? Here's a rather ambiguous reference from the PUD. Remaining areas of the county outside of the PPB scope may be served by alternative technologies. Those technologies are evaluated for consideration in future deployments of high-speed fiber. In other words, apparently these other technologies may be deemed adequate alternatives to fiber. If Chelan PUD is assuming that we already have DSL, they are wrong. We do not have real DSL on Eagle Creek Road. And as some examples of that, in Wenatchee, Frontier DSL reaches speeds of 24 megabytes per second. This is still a quarter the speed of fiber, which can reach 100 megabytes. Our home internet has a speed of 0.37 megabytes, 0.37. It takes 3 seconds to download a single megabyte. Taking into account modern data usage trends, let's see how this matches up. And you can compare DSL in Wenatchee compared to DSL on Eagle Creek Road, and it's like night and day. There's really no valid comparison. There's no equivalency. to download a 5 gigabyte movie, for example, would take Yeah, DSL in Wenatchee would take 3.5 minutes to download a 5 gigabyte movie. And anyway, there are many comparisons. Okay, so on our road, it goes from about 5 to 7 megabytes per second to 0.37, sometimes 1, sometimes within that range. But you can see that it's the contrast is pretty significant. Our other neighbors at mile 3.3, Paul Hedin, it's 2.29, 1.41. I mean, compared to what DSL is like in the city, there's just no comparison. And of course, fiber is a whole world apart. So the service we're getting is not even adequate, really. So, you know, if you've made the assumption that you already have DSL, don't worry about them. Not really true. So, that's what we're living that with now, and we'd like to start over soon with fiber instead of settling for subpar technology. The demand on the PUD will remain and grow stronger, not diminish. Meanwhile, costs will escalate. So we strongly suggest that our utility district factor that into planning. Pull out your maps and consider revising the benefit zones and including our eager and enthusiastic residents of our road. I mean, if we have well over 100 signatures on our petition at this point. And ultimately, I think we'd all benefit. So thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, I'm Paul Hedin, 9425 Eagle Creek Road, Leavenworth. I'm going to address the meeting minutes that Mike had sent out. I believe you've all seen a draft of it. There's only a couple of issues that we had with his minutes. Other than that, he pretty well identified how our meeting went with him earlier. One of the questions and comments we had was the criteria that must be met for selection to the PPB. We've never really gotten anything firm other than it was decided on back in 2015. So we're hoping that we can either get something better or just get included. Would be nice. One of the statements that was made in here was that the values for the PPB were established in 2015, and in fact, the values that were analyzed in 2015 were nothing more than something brought up from the original data in 2011. So we'd like to make sure that you understand it's been a long time since we've had updated data for determining the PPP. And another thing that Mike committed to was working very closely with the Public Works to get our installations done. And among that was adding the conduit in our phase two of the road project that might be needed. There was no analysis done. He did commit to doing the analysis and installing any conduit that was required. So those are the main things that we're looking at that were not included in what we believe is what you're looking at for our previous meeting. And now I think I'll turn it back over to Kevin to finish up.
Thanks, Paul. So I guess I'd like to also extend the opportunity if there's someone else here that is from the road that wanted to speak that hasn't had the opportunity. I'd sure like to make sure that we give you an opportunity to speak.
No.
Oh, okay.
Hello, everyone. I'm Sue Osborne at 11207 Eagle Creek Road. The only thing I would like to add to your analysis of what we have available on Eagle Creek Road for internet capability is SkyFi. We've all heard of SkyFi. And of course, my job as the CIO of Cashmere Valley Bank requires me to stay connected quite considerably. And because I believe because of my relationship with LocalTel in business, I was provided with SkyFi, and it was almost impossible. I have a series of poles, and the pole that could actually even begin to talk to one of these SkyFi dishes is out there. I have a cord that runs across the ground, top of the ground, in order to bring internet connection to my house with SkyFi. There has been an analysis done by LocalTel about installing other SkyFi because that is an alternative, right? Eagle Creek is not eligible. The way the creek is, the way the mountains run through that canyon, there is no way that there can be any viable SkyFi on that canyon. But I wanted to make sure that you knew that.
Thank you, Sue.
Did you?
My name is Alex Steele. I am the son of my mom, Elizabeth Steele. And I recently graduated from college at Western Washington University this December, and so I returned from there back home. And as much as the transition away from college as that was, I think the biggest transition to me has been the internet. I went from a college environment where we didn't have, you know, the most expensive internet, maybe a 30 megabyte per second connection, but going from that to a 0.3 megabyte per second connection. I think most people in this modern day live their entire lives not really realizing what that is like. Because as bad as our internet was back when we had dial-up, it was still relatively in the early days of the internet. We had websites, didn't have very much stuff on them. Ads on the internet weren't as much of a thing. It's a different world out now. The internet is everywhere, and especially on just even basic websites. My dad gets up every single morning to check the news. Now, if I'm up at that time and I'm doing anything, watching a video, playing a game or something, my connection will be instantly interrupted and completely destroyed to the point where I cannot watch a video, I cannot play a game with my friends, I cannot do anything. If even something as simple as a website that has some images that pop up and maybe a little 3-second ad movie, that will drain the entirety of the internet connection that we have available. And so people find themselves on their road in an environment where they have to spend a ridiculous amount of their conscious time thinking about, how am I going to use the internet? Will this work? Will this video that I just spent money to purchase actually even be able to be delivered to me? I know when we were watching Game of Thrones, we were trying to watch them sequentially, you know, like as they were coming out, and we didn't know whether that Sunday night we were actually going to be able to watch the episode, or whether halfway through when Daenerys was doing something cool, the connection was just going to die on us, and we were going to left there heartbroken. And that's a feeling that we're not willing to sacrifice money for that. I mean, we would pay ridiculous amount of money that you can't even imagine for something as basic as internet, but we're not given the option in, you know, the place where we live to pay somebody to get us better internet, and we are relying on the PUD to help us out and really understand what our situation's like. And I think it's also important to consider where our road is located. This is a beautiful, idyllic road with lots of very nice houses and new real estate and places for sale. The start of the road is 2 miles from Leavenworth. Prosperous Leavenworth, where people come flooding in from Seattle all the time. People want to retire in Leavenworth, spend time there. We know dozens of people on our road that would happily move to Leavenworth full-time and telecommute from their houses on Eagle Creek Road. And the only thing standing in the way of that is their terrible internet connection. And at first they think they can make it work, and then they realize how truly bad it is, and they are blocked. And I'm sure if I was any of these owners that had a piece of property that I wanted to sell to some of these Seattle residents that want to move over here, and I was unable to make a good deal and get the value that I deserved out of the piece of property or the house that I wanted to sell just because of internet, and there was just an ambiguous figure on when that problem would be resolved, that's a terrifying position to be in. And I think the, you know, everybody on the commission should just understand that there are a lot of people whose lives are literally being changed and held hostage due to the internet that we have. This is also combined with the fact that Eagle Creek does not get cell service. You cannot get reliable cell service where you can receive calls or do anything using data to circumnavigate not having good internet. So even though a lot of places may not have a DSL line to them, if they are in a semi-open valley, someplace they can get SkyFi or can get service from a cell provider, they can get some alleviation from this. But we rely almost entirely on the internet that we can get up the valley. So I just hope you kind of understand how much this affects our lives in very fundamental ways in, you know, our kind of technology-driven world where everybody, their business stuff, their entertainment, their friends are all on the internet. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Just a couple of last points, and we'll wrap this up. I did want to share with the commission, just thinking about some of the comments that were just made, a recent phone conversation that I had with Frontier in regards to internet service on Eagle Creek Road. When we're talking about viable options that might be out there, whether it be access through a cell provider or SkyFi or some other technology, my conversation with Pete Sima at Frontier told me that basically, you know, we're maxed out where phase one ended on Eagle Creek Road. The switch or the mainframe that they have located at Walker Canyon, which is just over a mile up the road, reaches maximum capacity at 3.2 miles. The road ends at 5.5. So we have that drop off from 1 mile to 3.2, gradually dropping off. And past that point, it drops off even further. He further shared with me that one of the obstacles that we've got is it's copper wire. It's old copper wire, and it's not very good quality copper wire. So they don't envision doing anything in there to replace the copper wire. I asked him about the possibility of boosting signal, and he told me there's no option to do that. The technology is not available to boost the signal, and I think in reality, even if the technology was there, you know, when we start talking about getting to that far end of the valley, I don't know that the cost is going to be justified based on the number of homes that are up there. I wanted to also ask of the commission if, you know, we've given you some information here and there's been some conversation. Are there any questions that any of you have while we're here that we can answer, or any thoughts or insights that you wish to share with us?
Question here. You indicated at the beginning there's 134 homeowners. How many homes does that represent?
That's 134 homes that are on the road. Those are people that actually have PUD service. They're invoiced by Chelan County PUD for electric services.
And that's in about 5 miles?
5.5.
And the road rebuild that the county is currently doing, will it be then the complete road?
Yes, it will. Yeah, they completed 3.2 miles, which is right where Paul and Rosemary's house is. And we heard in January that they were planning to finish it starting in May of this year. So it's going to be a quick project. Evidently, they're going to start in May, and they'll be done 35 days later in June. Any other questions? I guess just to wrap everything up, we have some petitions that I'm going to leave with the commission here. We've had over 100 of those 134 residents sign up, put their signature on a petition, whether it's an online petition or a hard copy, indicating that when this service is available, we will sign up. The 30-some that are not signed up, we're still getting signatures as late as this morning. We had one or two came in just this morning. So we're still getting some of those signatures in. We're also hearing that a significant number Of that 30-plus, most of those are absentee owners. So we've had support from them saying, you know, yeah, we really do want to have this service when we move there, but we're still 3 years, 5 years out before, you know, we're going to be in a position to move. So that, in part, is why we haven't gotten those additional signatures.
Okay. Kevin, could you, again, give me the number in terms of the absentee owners? Approximately?
It's approximately 30.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, it's approximately 30. There was one last thought that I did want to share with you that came up at the meeting that Mike Coleman and Steve McKenna put together for us, and it's been brought to my attention a couple of times after the meeting. So I did want to share it with the board, and I guess I want to acknowledge it in light of conversation that we heard from a young person that's just recently graduated from college. We've had teachers, there's at least four teachers on Eagle Creek Road, and as most of you are probably aware, when it comes to technology and the use of the internet, most of our students are required to have access to internet in order to do homework, in order to take care of other academic requirements that are part of their education. Dwayne Allen, one of those teachers, shared with us at the meeting that his son was unable to submit his homework because he didn't have enough internet speed to be able to actually, you know, upload the information that he needed to get into his teacher. So there's a pretty significant impact that is going to be levied against our young people moving forward if we don't do something to address the issue. And I do realize that, you know, the issue is not just, you know, here with PUD, but also, you know, providing this information to our legislators, both at the regional and the state level, as well as at the federal level, just underscoring the importance and the need for having high-quality internet service available for everyone to access. I just want to cover the four items that we came here to talk about again. The outcome that we're looking for is to bring high-speed fiber internet service to all the residences on Eagle Creek Road. We're also requesting the PUD reconsider adding Eagle Creek Road into the PPB fiber build-out footprint and plans. We're requesting inclusion in the periodic reviews relative to future planning activities and communication processes. And last, developing a working partnership with the PUD to address these issues moving forward, advocating for high-speed internet services. I'd like to thank the Commission for your time. I'd like to thank you for your willingness to listen to what we had to say here today. And I'm hopeful that moving forward we can figure out a way to work together to address the issues that we're dealing with here in Chelan County.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Kevin.
I think we'd like to ask Mike to come up if he could just to offer his thoughts.
Mike Coleman, please.
Thank you. Mike Coleman, Managing Director of Fiber and Telecom. My thoughts. I think what you've heard this afternoon is a microcosm of the national rural broadband problem, both the unserved and the underserved. There is a tremendous demand for high-speed broadband, be it fiber or some other technology. That's part of what we heard as the voice of the customer owners back during the strategic planning in 2015. That's what created the public power benefit program that we're operating under now. There was a clear consensus to restart the program, to do it in a reasonable manner at a reasonable cost, and it resulted in the proposal that we expand to 85% to 90% of the county for a cost of roughly $25 million. That's not a program that happens overnight. It's also a program that we consistently look at, evaluate, and reanalyze the areas that haven't been built, looking for changes, looking for will that area be reasonable to build or unreasonable to build? Any of the areas that are reasonable to build and that fits inside that $25 million limit that the commission gave me are looked at and potentially included in the program. I think the issue that this all comes down to, of course, is the timing. The question of whether an area is built in 2018, 2019, or all the way up through 2026. And in doing that, we consistently look at the guidance, the criteria that the commission gave us. Probably the most important one that I think about daily is what's on the wall back here, the best for the most for the longest. And in doing that, we included in the criteria and we work with the electrical side to make sure that we're consistently making good decisions that offer the best benefits to the entire district and the district's customer owners in doing that. Eagle Creek specifically was not included in the initial package because of the information that we had at the time. We now know and have known for a little while that there was updated information. As with every other area that falls in that category, we look at it, we say it needs to be reevaluated, and then it goes into that process, the annual process, to say when can it be built, when is a good choice of times for both the fiber and the electrical department. When does all the priorities come together to say this area needs to be built this year? And that's a process that's ongoing. It's a process that's consistent. And it will ultimately result in meeting the objectives of the Public Power Benefit Program, which is reaching that 85 to 90% of the county for the $25 million that was envisioned at the start of the program. I think the other topic that I would go to is the fact that even with this public power benefit program, at the end of the day when the program is over, there's still somewhere between 10 and 15% of the county that's not going to have service. We've talked about that many times in front of this board. We've talked about the economics of it. We've also talked about the search for alternative technologies that would make it economically feasible to build to all areas. We haven't found that alternative technology at this point. Sue referred to the difficulties with SkyFi in that valley, and I immediately thought back to Bob Shane's presentation on the wireless proof of concept where we looked at the INEAT Valley, which is very, very similar. So we still have a lot of work to do on alternative technologies, particularly looking for a disruptive technology that would provide a reasonable service at a reasonable price. We're not there yet. We continue to look, and we will continue to explore that. As far as Eagle Creek Road itself goes, we are very much aware of it. I think I, of all people, am so aware of the necessity of broadband connections. It's my desire to get them as far out into the county as possible. What's going to happen with Eagle Creek is that we have placed it into that list of eligible areas, and as we reach a point in time where we have the availability of resources and we have an agreement on both the electrical and the fiber side that now is the time to build it, then it will go into the process and you will see it come up in one of the annual budgets. I'm open for questions.
So I would have two questions, Mike, and we've talked about them before. So the question of can Eagle Creek be covered by fiber? And that answer is yes. It's been determined to be an eligible area.
The answer today is yes. We believe it's a reasonable area to build to.
Okay. And so then the remaining question, and probably the one that stirs the emotions the deepest, is when? Mm-hmm. And so we've talked about that. I'm somewhat reluctant to even mention any date because we don't have control over all circumstances. Things happen. Mm-hmm. I think a prime example would have been the winter situation at Lake Wenatchee several years ago, which consumed huge amounts of time and parts of the budget to reinstate fiber in that area. So I know we can't say definitively, but as I have expressed to you, I would like to see us in that area, you know, around the 2019 area, if possible, because there are commitments that have been made and budgets that need to be met and the schedule that needs to be to maintain that we've already committed to. Is 2019, it may be an unfair question, within the realm of possibility?
I would tell you that it's bordering on being an unfair question.
So, as you know me well, that's not unusual for me to ask it, but yes.
It's within the realm of possibility,
right?
But I don't know what the unknowns are,
right,
in 2019,
right,
at this particular moment in time.
Yeah.
So let me take a shot at that, because I would agree with Mike that
And I know I'm making the two of you itchy, but that's part of my job.
So I think there are a number of things that have to be taken into account. First of all, the board made a decision to get back into this business, at that time said we're going to do the $25 million across 10 years, roughly $2.5 million a year. Things change. And at that point, we were anticipating substantially higher wholesale revenues than what we've experienced in the last 3 years. And I think there was even a hope that maybe the program could grow through time, but we're not generating the revenues off the wholesale electric side that make it easy to be able to expand the program. In fact, actually, to the board's credit, the board has maintained the program despite the financial challenges that we've confronted in the last few years. So how much revenue we generate would be one factor to consider. Second, we are very active in terms of every piece of legislation that comes along to think about whether there could be federal or state dollars for rural broadband, and trying to make sure that when people think about that, they make sure that they take into account a place like Chelan County, where we have been early achievers. Sometimes those dollars tend to be targeted towards the low-hanging fruit. We've tended to achieve the low-hanging fruit, and so that would put us at a disadvantage, and that doesn't seem fair. So we're trying to make sure that we're active in terms of describing why it is that Chelan County should not be penalized for being an early achiever. Third, there's a lot of stuff going on here, as this board knows. We spent a lot of time this morning talking about the new large loads that are coming at us and the potential for the impact on our workload. And at the moment, that is very unpredictable. So we've got a lot of things coming where we may potentially have to be involved in construction programs to be able to serve electric loads. And we just don't know yet how big that program is going to be. There is, unfortunately, an overlap between that work and what goes on in fiber, because we're stringing fiber on distribution poles. And it's basically the same people who end up having to do that work. So the hesitation that you see from us in terms of being able to say, yes, we can commit that this will happen, is we do not want to overpromise and underdeliver. We do not want to make a commitment that we can do something and then we are unable to make that work. The process we've been using is we go through our work plan for the year, and as we get into the third quarter, we look at how have we done in terms of accomplishing that work plan. What are the opportunities for us to be able to create value for customers in the next year and try to bring that back to the board in the fourth quarter of the year when we have the best available information for how much can we get done? We think it's very clear to us. The board wants us to be as aggressive as possible in terms of getting fiber out there within the financial limits, the budget limits that we've got. So that much I can commit to you is we're going to do the best we can to be able to get out there. As Mike said, he and his team have been out and looked at Eagle Creek a couple of times now since this group has put it on our screen. And we're becoming very, very familiar with the specifics around that. There's a couple of things that came up today that I think are opportunities for us to explore a bit more, and we'll follow up on that. But in terms of being able to say for sure it will happen in this time frame, it would be very difficult for us to do that. In fact, I'm going to be honest and say it would be impossible for us to do that and be certain that, in fact, we could accomplish it.
Yeah. Thank you. Yes, please.
Steve. I just mentioned a couple things. I've got a question for Mike while he's here. First of all, I think if I look at the four goals that Kevin spoke about, actually, I'm going to back up even farther. First of all, I want to thank the residents of Eagle Creek for meeting with Mike and I and staff, and a very productive meeting, great turnout. I learned a lot, came away with it with some questions, and you know, my first reaction is, let's throw some extra money at this and get this to happen, right? Let's you know, everybody wants to get some things done. What I did realize with some further education that doesn't necessarily always solve the problem. That, you know, as Mike has shared with us, we've got to combine with the service crew, make sure the poles are ready. But I think you are coming out of here today with a couple of things that you tried to get accomplished. One is inclusion in periodic review. We've stated that we would be doing that, working as partners. And I think you've also heard today that you're on the list. It's, someday we'll get to you. So I think there are some wins here today. But there was a question, I think, Paul, that I want to see if we can get to. Talk to me a little bit about what we can commit to with working with the county and coordinating with them on the road and going underground when needed in preparation and taking advantage of that.
Okay. First of all, I would say that's a usual and routine practice. As we're aware of county work, as we're aware of road work, primarily through the outreach of Andy Wendell and Chad Rissman's team, because they're having to look at it from electrical facility work, mm-hmm. We're aware of those, and we often place fiber conduit well ahead of any intention to build in that area, because it's a conduit is cheap. Cutting a road is very expensive. So if we even remotely think that we might need a way to get under a road, we include conduit in it. The second part of that was specifically after the meeting with the residents of Eagle Creek and with Keith Gaynor there. Keith made the commitment that they would be more than happy to work with us on that particular subject, and we plan on taking advantage of that. We don't know specifically where we're going to have to cross that road at. We have done no detailed engineering at this stage. What we will do is take advantage of the opportunity to place some conduits under the road in case they're needed. Bob Shane and I drove that road Friday afternoon specifically to just look at it again and say, are there any troubled spots here? What do we see that could either cause trouble with the installation of fiber or potentially drive up the cost of installing fiber? We will take advantage of that to work with our customer service engineers to see if we can go ahead and place conduit in strategic locations to get under that road.
Okay. So I guess in answering your question, Dennis, you know, it seems like there's a lot that's been accomplished here today. Someday we're going to work on it. But that's more than you had before.
It is.
And they're going to, Mike and his group are going to work with the county to get those underground conduit things done if they need to be done. And this commission will remember that you were here, and we appreciate your time being here, and we look forward to getting it done someday.
Again, thank you very much. Do I give the additions to
Rebecca?
To Rebecca, please.
And yeah. One more question for Mike on the impact of if, in fact, there's a 100 residences indicating a desire to sign up, that probably can effectively alter the position on that list?
We always like to know of customer desire and particularly customer intent that they follow through on signing up and taking the service. From a holistic perspective, it does land with favor for us. But as I mentioned at the meeting out in Leavenworth, at the end of the day, I am here to serve equally all of the 85 to 90% that we can build to. And we have not used that as a particular priority point because there's so many other criteria that tend to come ahead of that. We know through our earlier planning, particularly during the strategic planning, we need an overall 40% take rate on the expansion for it to be financially sustainable for us. We have a lot of experience at that, and in looking at the different areas that we're including in it, we are making sure that overall we balance the system and stay above that 40% take rate. So it indirectly impacts it.
You had a question out here.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did you have a microphone, please? Thank you.
And tell us your name.
Linda Surratt, 10897 Eagle Creek. I just want to know currently how far the conduit is up Eagle Creek now. Did they put it in when they did the first phase of the road rebuild?
Let me start that answer by reiterating that fiber follows the path of the electrical infrastructure. So there's probably a little bit over 1,000 feet of conduit that was installed with the original road work. The reason it was only 1,000 feet is because that's at the point where the electricity comes from underground to overhead. So where the electricity is overhead, I have no need for conduit unless I need to get under the road from one side to the other. So we're in good shape as far as the electrical infrastructure.
Steve, thanks for noticing. A couple of points in terms of clarification. When the commission decided to curtail the build out, we were probably somewhere in the neighborhood of about $135 million, I'm thinking, in terms of what we had done as far as build out. And that was all debt financed internally. At the same time, I know when Commissioner Smith and I came on, just previous to that, we were $1,060,000,000 in debt as an institution. So it was very apparent that we needed to get our finances in order, because when you run out of resources, you run out of service. And so that was a necessary thing to do. And then after when Mike Coleman and basically his current crew came on, we decided to continue but on basically a cash basis going forward, or public benefit dollars going forward, which is much more reasonable. It doesn't continue to add to that debt that people were very clear they wanted us to reduce. So that's kind of a little bit of the history of that. And then regarding the Rust grant, as commissioners, I remember at the time it was a really difficult decision, because anytime you get married to the federal government in a grant, it can be a difficult issue. And it didn't take long for the difficulties of that relationship to come to the forefront. There were very, very clear construction deadlines laid out to meet, for us to meet, with significant penalties if we didn't meet them. So that was one part of the grant. The other part was the federal government was also responsible for issuing permits to do much of the work. So they were very clear about the deadlines, but not so helpful on the permitting. So the clock was running, and we couldn't get the permits out of them. And so it became apparent to us that we were trapped, that we were not going to be able to get the permits necessary to do the work, but we're still going to be held liable for the construction dates. And so at that point, our worst nightmare was realized. We declined that and decided to move forward on a basically on a cash basis and not have that encumbrance. So, I mean, there's just two things that I just wanted, you know, clarification on. And so I think, again, there were promises made. There were promises broken, but not by Mike Coleman and his crew. As a commissioner, I had been personally notified that commitments to Eagle Creek were going to be fulfilled, and at one point was informed that those commitments had been made. And so didn't hear or see you people for a long time. And that was, to a certain extent, a form of confirmation that what had been promised had been delivered, and was very surprised a couple of weeks ago when the emails started coming forward related to that there was not fiber in Eagle Creek. And to your point, my wife and I lived in Sunny Slope for 14 years. The first 5 years, we had a twisted pair of copper dial-up through Verizon, and you talked about you would pay anything. I was consulting with a company out of College Station, Texas. They paid the bill, but it was $485 a month for dial-up that was totally inadequate, but it was a remote office. And so, been there, done that, don't want to leave you with it. So I think, hopefully, and feel free to contact any or all of us, staff included as well. Well, I would say particularly staff. but let us work with you and move forward and honor our commitment to you. And thank you for being here. Yes, sir.
Two quick comments. One is, Mike stated that there was 1,000 feet of conduit on Eagle Creek. It's actually 8,000 feet. And the other is, one of our big concerns right now is the county tells us there's a 5-year moratorium on cutting the road once they've finished their project. If you guys don't get your conduit to cross the road now, it's 5 years before you can do it. So it's just that part alone is very critical to happen soon, because they're doing that early summer.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just had a couple, just actually one question really. It's what Mike said. Mike, I know you'd like to paint this Eagle Creek situation as a microcosm of the greater internet struggle that our country has. But I think what you did point out was that when Eagle Creek Road was originally assessed whether or not it needed to be as part of this expansion, you said yourself that you got inaccurate information, and that at that time when you were supposed to get out there and assess the quality of the internet on the road and how it would match up against other viable locations, that information right there was not the accurate information that you needed to make the proper decision regarding Eagle Creek Road. And I think that that's the important point that the commission really needs to consider, is that that improper assessment of the road at that point where, I mean, it seems like there's still a lot of confusion that has spread from that point. I mean, you yourself just said that you were under the impression that the internet problem had been fixed. I personally believe that 100% of this problem really stems from that inaccurate assessment, and that from that inaccurate assessment, we now have been kicked way down the playing field rather unfairly, even though it was not our fault at all, and we had no idea that we had been assessed inaccurately. So my question to Mike is that in response to that inaccurate assessment, what steps have you and the PUD taken to kind of compensate or accept that that was a mistake that was made, that was not the resident's fault, and that was not our responsibility to come forward and make this known, and that it was kind of up beyond us, and that we were out of the loop even when this was going on?
Let me offer some clarity. The PUD did not assess in any shape, form, or fashion what internet was available in any given area. That's not our concern, okay? What we did do is we looked at the electrical infrastructure, and that's what drives the initial estimates of a build. So in the case of Eagle Creek, the records had simply not been updated with the electrical infrastructure. That's the change in information, change in data that happens. And that goes on in a, I'll say, a routine and continual basis. The electrical side is out rebuilding areas because of their reliability issues. And as they change their electrical infrastructure, it often makes it much more economical and easy to put the fiber back into that area. So it's an ongoing process that as the electrical infrastructure is changed, it often has a very positive impact on the deployment of fiber. I don't go out and measure Frontier's internet speeds. That doesn't serve any purpose for me. I don't measure Charter cable TV's internet speeds. And we do not take that into account when we look at an area for deploying fiber. That would be unfair as a whole to the customer owners that are wanting fiber. So our choice and our saying that Eagle Creek is viable is simply from a PUD fiber perspective, it is a viable area for us to build to. So just, I wanted a little clarification on that.
Okay, so it wasn't the internet assessment that was off, it was the electrical assessment for the potential for the fiber.
And if you wanted to put that into specific terms, it has to do with the construction parameters of a given area. So that's one of the many challenges that we face in looking at different areas, is with the infrastructure that's in that area, what's it going to do to the cost of deploying fiber? A quick, simple example of that is that if I go build fiber into an area that's going to cost me $15,000 per home passed, and yet I know that the electrical side has a rehabilitation project planned in 2 years, and as a result of that rehabilitation project, it's going to lower my cost to, say, $4,000 per home. I'm going to wait that 2 years to gain that cost advantage simply because I feel like I'm spending customer owner money when I do that, and I need to be responsible in spending that money.
I want to make sure I've got this right. So the determination that was made at the time the strategic plan was adopted was as to what areas would qualify and what areas would not. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that there was a misunderstanding at that time and Eagle Creek was not included, that has been fixed, and it is now included. This is Commissioner McKenna's point from earlier, I believe.
Yes, yes.
So I think that to the extent there was a problem, it's fixed. So.
So again, I just want to thank
the
commission. I think we've made a lot of progress here today. We've obviously gotten answers to a number of questions that we were hoping to get answers to. I also want to just acknowledge and express appreciation to both Mike and Steve McKenna and also to Randy, you know, for taking the time to meet with us and talk with us and listen to what we had to say and advocate for making sure that we've got good, clear communications between the PUD and your customer owners out on Eagle Creek Road. So we look forward to more communication, more conversations, and eventually, I know we can't give a firm date, but eventually, you know, having that opportunity to connect with high-speed fiber on internet on Eagle Creek Road.
Yeah, and Kevin, to you and your neighbors, thank you for the civil tone, you know. Randy and I and Mike had the opportunity to attend a meeting at Squirrel Tree X number of years ago where we were the menu at the restaurant, and it did not go as kindly as this. But having said that, because you've been soft-spoken and because you've been civil doesn't mean that you have not been heard and understood. So I there's no need to have the Squirrel Tree restaurant. We've done really well today, and thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Yes, thank you.
Kevin,
thank you.
By the way, for the folks up Eagle Creek that don't know me as well as you know my wife and Sue knows me and my background, and I do apologize for not making that meeting, but as Sue will attest, Sue and I went around in the first wars on fiber in – we were in agreement sometimes, disagreement at other times. But I'm sorry that you moved away from Cashmere, because I think there's fiber to your place in Cashmere now.
There is no correlation, however. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, let's talk about the consent agenda.
So can we take a 5 minute break?
Yes, we'll take a 5 minute break. We'll start back up at quarter after.
Okay.
Great. Sorry.
Okay, we're resuming our meeting. It is now 2:15, and we will be taking a look at the consent agenda. Commissioners, what is your desire?
I would move approval of the consent agenda.
Is there a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to approve the consent agenda as presented. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion is carried. Regular agenda, resolution 10.
A resolution ratifying amendment number 1 to services agreement SA number 11-157 with the Okanagan Nation Aquatic Enterprises Limited and Public Utility District number 2 of Grant County for sockeye hatchery compensation related to the Rocky Beach and Rock Island hydroelectric projects. Hello, Elaine Underwood.
Hello. That was a mouthful. Good afternoon, commissioners. As Steve mentioned, I'm the Fish and Wildlife Manager for the district. Today I'm asking for support to ratify amendment 1 to services agreement 11-157 with Okanagan Nation Aquatic Enterprises and Grant County Public Utility District. The original services agreement was authorized under Resolution 11-13682 in October of 2011 and approved the design and construction of a sockeye hatchery and continuation of the monitoring and evaluation program for reintroduction of sockeye into Skaha Lake in British Columbia. In 2012, district staff executed amendment number 1 to the services agreement, which clarified that the 17.5% administrative fee authorized in the original agreement applied to all non-construction related expenses, not just labor and equipment, and that a 2% administrative fee would be applied to hatchery construction related costs until such time as the construction was completed. Incidentally, construction was completed in 2014. At the time, staff incorrectly assessed Amendment Number 1 as a zero-cost amendment, and as a result, no further legal review or board approval was sought prior to executing that amendment. The amendment should have been presented for consideration and approval to the board, as the effect of the changes to the administrative fees projected over the remaining 45 years of the agreement exceeded the threshold for board action. This error was identified in the district's own internal audit of the Skaha Hatchery Construction Closeout Review. Subsequently, Fish and Wildlife and PCS staff have worked to confirm that, one, project managers are completing their service agreement routing forms and checklists themselves and not delegating to others. Two, project managers understand their delegated authority for all approvals. And three, coordination with a contract specialist is paramount. In closing, I would like to request ratification of the Amendment Number 1, clarifying the application of the administrative fees, as well as ratification of the amounts paid pursuant to the amendment. All expenditures authorized under that amendment have been approved in the board's annual budgets. With that, I would be happy to answer any questions the board may have.
Commissioners, any questions? Hearing none.
I would move that we approve the resolution. Which one do we have at
10?
Number 10 as written.
Okay. It's been moved. Is there a second?
I'll second it.
It's been moved and seconded to accept resolution 10 as presented. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor of supporting the resolution signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no. The motion is carried.
Thank you.
Alina, how often do we have somebody up at the hatchery physically observing what's going on? I know it's not terribly frequently.
We actually try and get up there about once a quarter. Okay. Someone from the hatchery department gets up there.
Okay. I'm just curious, because, I mean, that's, you know, a pretty good hike up to British Columbia.
Yes, it is.
Well, that's what the sockeye say. You
know? Yeah. They have to work hard for that.
Is that something that maybe one of us commissioners might...
I've been there before.
Have you been there before?
I have. And it was...
We can talk about that later, but...
Definitely. Yeah. It's a beautiful place. Lots of really good fish raised there. We'd be happy to take you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Eileen, thank you. Resolution 11.
Resolution rejecting the bid of American Wire Group Incorporated, Schedules A through C, and Annixter Incorporated, Schedule A, and accepting the bid of General Pacific Incorporated, Schedule A, and Annixter Incorporated, Schedules B and C, bid 17-90, for the supply of distribution cable and conductor.
Good afternoon, Commissioners.
And could you state your name and position for the recording, please?
Lyle Moore, Customer Service Engineering Supervisor.
Thank you.
Earlier this year in February, District went to bid for various sizes and quantities of overhead and underground primary and secondary conductor. This bid is for our annual construction needs. The utility received bids from three companies. The bids that we received from American Wire for schedules A, B, and C, and from Annixter and Corp for schedule A, did not meet the minimum requirements of the contract documents. The companies submitted bids for products that are not on our approved list. They did not submit technical data or samples to allow us to review these products to see if there is as good or better. So therefore, we deem these bids as non-responsive. And schedules B and C for Annixter, they did produce bids for products that are on our approved list. And for Schedule A from General Pacific, they produced a product that is on our approved list. So after review, it is recommended by staff that we award bid number 1790, Schedule A, to General Pacific, and Schedules B and C to Annixter and Corp. I'm available for any questions.
Commissioners?
Commissioners, I might just say in our pre-meeting, we had a pretty extended conversation about the amount of effort that goes into trying to make sure the bidders understand the product that they're supposed to provide. So it's a bit surprising to us, honestly, that we're running into this problem of people bidding things that are not compliant with the specs.
It is. If I could add, too, we did extensive testing last fall to reapprove, to try to get a really good handle on who's approved and who is meeting our requirements. And it's been a challenge getting products that are meeting our standards. We do have approved products, and we do have multiple vendors that can provide those products. So we are confident that we can get good bids. We need to get people to respond. And we've had conversations with PCS on ways to encourage response. Unfortunately, I think, as an example, we're still kind of small in the utility industry when it comes to products.
We are looking at participating. Energy Northwest is trying to put together a joint purchasing agreement, and that's one option for us in terms of being able to look a little bigger.
Yes.
Even that would be a very positive thing to do. I've had good experience with that, but these look like pretty good numbers then.
Mm-hmm.
So just need to be more responsive.
Yes, they do.
But good numbers. All right.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, hearing no further discussion, is there a motion?
I move that we accept resolution number 8. Where did that go? Second.
It's been moved and seconded to accept resolution 11 as presented. Any further discussion or comments? Hearing none, those in favor of supporting the motion as presented, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion is carried.
Okay. Thank you.
Lyle, thank you very much. So we have, according to this morning's discussion, one half of the manager items left.
That's right, actually. Unfortunately, I did overlook one, so we have two to do. Janet and John Wasniewski will give us an update on the snow survey.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Janet Jaspers, Energy Planning and Trading Manager. And today it's my pleasure to introduce John Wasniewski. And so he was our recent hire as an energy analyst. And just a little background, originally from Southern Oregon. And he's a football player, ended up going to college at the United States Military Academy at West Point.
Oh.
So played football. So. And he's he does have one downfall. He loves the Green Bay Packers. So we always have arguments in our group about
Seahawks. Wasn't there enough demerit?
Yeah. Seahawks, Green Bay Packers. It's not all good. But, other things about John, loves the outdoors. So he has a lot of in common with a lot of us. He's engaged, getting married in August, so wish him well with that. And,
John, your home community, if I may ask?
Home community?
Yeah.
Rogue Valley, Central Point, Medford area?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
I grew up in Phoenix.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I was a Phoenix Pirate. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Greater Comet.
Yeah. Yeah, one of my close friends was a long-term principal at Greater before he retired. So we used to be in the same league.
Mm-hmm.
It was a good rival. Yeah. Congratulations on your time at West Point.
Thank you.
Then finding and having the wisdom to come to work for Lincoln at PUD. There's just a whole lot of things that are likable here.
I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.
Good. Thank you. And thanks for your service.
So we've been doing a lot of training with him. So he is now taking over Lakeland operations. And so I'm going to turn it over to him to give you this snowpack update.
I think we have some slides. Thank you, Janet. Good afternoon, Commissioners. Quick update on our snow surveys. After we were unable to conduct the first of three planned annual snow surveys, we were able to get up a week ago on Monday the 26th. And what we found was at Lyman Lake, which is
the highest elevation of the three sites we monitor, about 118% of average snow water equivalent, 101 at Park Creek Ridge and 105 at Rainy Pass, which helped us to formulate our March 1st water supply forecast of 106%. And we do have one more snow survey planned, which will result in our final water supply forecast, which will come out on April 1st. And what this means in the big picture is, at this time, we are following the dry and average target curve. So you can see here, our current lake elevation is about right in the middle of our forecasted operating range. We expect to get down to the dry average curve here in a week to 2 weeks, at which time we'll slow the draft of the lake and follow that target curve. But so far up to this year, it's been a very normal year as far as the drafting of the lake. Any questions in relation to the snow survey program or the lake levels?
No, this is Chelan County's version of the duck diagram, by the way.
Part of the local education.
Yeah. Any questions?
I had a comment for Janet. It's a total aside, but the surveys that you bring us periodically, I greatly appreciate. I actually go to the Northwest River Forecast Center site on a regular basis and had the opportunity a couple weeks ago to educate my brother-in-law, who's from Chicago, and he's got a place over on Swan Lake, in the right by Lake Flathead Lake, about that diagram, and come to find out we're sitting at 150% of normal precipitation over there at the Hunger Horse Reservoir, right? 144%, something like that. But, you know, that's, we call that our water too, because it does come through. So, you know, the interaction over time is much appreciated.
Where are we with off the top of your head with the Canadian pack?
The Grand Coulee runoff forecast is the kind of the 10-day informed with 10-day weather forecast is right around 110% of average.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
Bouncing up and down depending on what you look.
Yeah.
Yeah. So kind of where we're at in north, it's kind of average or above average, but as you move south of us, Oregon and California, very dry.
All right. So our supply should be, at least now, okay, depending on runoff. Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you. Welcome aboard. It's nice to have another Southern Oregonian, you know, in among the pack here.
Thank you.
I want to ask Mike Coleman to come up. Respond to a question that came up at a previous board meeting.
Like we haven't seen Mike enough today.
Huh? That's cruel.
No, he's probably going, not these.
So do I need to say my name again?
No, I'm just.
Commissioner Bowles, when you ask about capacity for the electrical side as a result of HDL large loads, you included fiber in there. So I did want to go ahead and provide an answer for that. Generically, there are no capacity issues with the fiber network. We have plenty of capacity, and we have zero concerns right now where that's concerned. Okay. The couple of things I wanted to mention with that, though, is that it's more than just our network. So there's some caveats depending upon what type of service they want, which retail service provider, or if they're going to bring their own carrier. Those don't affect our capacity, but they do impose some administrative requirements on us. The other thing we're seeing is that there are plans to either build a group or maybe multiple groups of locations where they would need service. Our deal there is it falls under the line extension program, so we will build whatever they're willing to pay for, and we can do it in a reasonable time frame. We are encouraging them that if they're bringing in multiple companies or multiple players, to look at the combined needs so that we only have to build once. So, other than that, most of the Bitcoin type operations require nothing more than a high-speed internet connection, and we have plenty of capacity.
Okay.
So,
all right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
And thanks for letting me give you a bad time.
I think Tracy went home in tears.
Yeah, I know him better than that.
That's it for me.
He has hunted me down. All right. Commission items, I think we covered this morning. Anybody think of anything in between? Okay, that. Commission travel.
We'll get it in.
Hello, I'm Lisa Sanders, admin in finance. And first, I want to thank you all for turning in your expense books timely. We got them all finished and to payroll, and so it makes things much, much easier for them when they have a double payroll like they do this month. So thank you very much from all of us. And I know I saw you just our last meeting, but we're getting back on track from your board retreat workshop. So not a lot has changed. I did hold rooms for New Orleans, and I just want to point out that there was a one-night deposit. So if you're looking through your expenses and something looks strange, it might be that. It's about $270, I think. So just wanted you to be aware that that's the hold for those reservations.
And this is the APPA annual conference, right?
Yes.
Okay, good.
And just one item. And are you going to go through all of these? Or
I don't, okay. Unless you want to.
No, the only one I wanted to point out was July, the policymakers. That's just me.
Okay.
And it ends on the 25th.
Do you know where it is? I could not find anything on it.
It's right next door to APPA headquarters in Arlington.
Oh.
Or Crystal City, I guess. It's right very close to the airport. And okay. I haven't got the list of hotels yet, but there's a couple of them right close to the state.
Okay. So you can forward me any information.
Yeah, I will. And I'll be needing on that one to do an alternate travel form.
Okay. So, Commissioner Arsenal, you're not doing that?
No, I'm the only appointee.
Okay.
So, I'll wait till you're done there. Sorry.
No, I'm good. Go ahead.
April 18 to 20 are the days of the meeting. So I'm just curious how many will actually need rooms on the 17th. It's in Skagit County.
3-hour drive?
About that. Yeah. Unless you want to do the North Cascade.
It won't be open.
Yeah. I'm just curious about that. And then I have a personal one I need to change because of an appointment on Friday.
Okay. So, Commissioner Bowles, do you?
I will not need the 18th is the only night I will need.
The 18th? Then check out the 19th?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't remember what the agenda is.
I don't think we've seen the agenda yet.
Commissioner Education usually starts at roundtable.
It's the annual.
It starts at 1 on Wednesday. So that's why.
This is the Tulip Festival, in case.
Yeah, I saw that.
That makes any difference. Could be extra busy.
Yeah. So I'm just curious. Here, I'm going to go.
We can change that later. That
day. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, as we get closer. But just a thought on that.
Yes.
Yeah.
I like to have that extra day ahead just in case.
Yeah.
When we can drop it without a penalty.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Okay. Commissioner Bowl?
I don't. I only need the 19th that week.
Okay.
So,
Lisa, for me on the Waputa, March 14th, 16th. I'm canceling out on that.
Oh, entirely? Okay. Thank you. Commissioner Bowles, did you want the 18th or 19th?
Or I need the...
wrong direction. I wrote down 18, but then I thought you said 19. So.
No.
You said both, the 18th and 19th.
Did I? Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm glad somebody's listening, although it's bad information.
Well, you would be checking in one day and out the other.
Right. I'll be needing a motel room the night of the 18th, and we will be checking out then the afternoon of the 19th. So we will be heading back to Wendy.
Okay. So one night of the 18th.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then on the May 9th and 10th for the Waputo Telecom, I will be turning my registration in to you today.
Oh, thank you.
We'll be going to that one. It will. Okay.
I think I might already have that.
It's on the second page.
You've got it.
Yep, top of second page.
Well, you've got
I have a check mark by it.
Oh, there it is. I'm sorry. Thank you.
I think we have it.
You do. Gosh, I'm telling you. Just realize how many people it takes to keep me straight. That's a bunch.
Well, I'd rather have it twice than not once.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Commissioner McKenna, I had a question for you on the APPA National Conference.
I need to get back to you.
Okay.
Sorry.
Oh, that's fine. Do you want this paperwork back? You can look through it.
Please.
Okay.
I already turned that into you. Oh, this. Okay, so yes, I'm going.
Yeah.
Yes.
Are you going to do Dave Giving?
Yes.
Yes, we are.
So there's three of us that are going to do that. That'll be great.
Okay, so I need.
I don't know what they'll have. But it might be in the seventh ward.
Thank you.
Cool. That would be very cool.
They go to places like that.
Sorry, Lisa. I need to listen and
that's who needs to
ask the question before I start interrupting.
That's all right. We'll get there. Can I help with anything else?
In case we haven't said it often enough, I appreciate this. I think everybody appreciates it.
I think that's collective, yes.
Thank you.
It helps me, too. Yeah. So,
thank you.
While this whole thing is a little nerve-wracking in the long run, it's very helpful.
And we never change our minds.
Never. You're just simplest group.
In many ways.
Again, thank you for your expense reports and your
You're welcome.
Books. So.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
So just let me know if I can help with anything.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Just a thought, commissioners, in terms of New Orleans. Orla's son, his wife, and some friends just returned from there. And one of the things they did is schedule a Katrina tour. And they just said it was one of the more eye-opening events to attend.
Because to the areas devastated? Is
that yeah. Oh. And it would be similar, from what I gathered, to the young gentleman that presented the Flint water issue at our state convention. So yeah. It's that kind of an eye-opening, educational, and so just a thought.
And I was sharing with Gary, you know, we're all doing the Day of Giving on that Friday before.
Yeah.
And wouldn't surprise me that took us into the seventh ward.
Yeah.
Entirely possible.
Yeah. Okay. Follow up on delegation items.
So we've got quite a few that are still in progress. We're looking at the how our sales match up to the current portfolio, the question that was asked again today. I will tell you that's a bit of a challenge just because, again, part of the question is we're selling a certain kind of product today and then it's moving over potentially to a retail sale. But as we've described, we're going to give people options as to what they might buy. So it could look the same or it could look quite different. So we're trying to figure out how we would put that together in a way that would show you something meaningful.
And Steve, I guess I really need to ask the question. Is the question worthy enough to justify the time being consumed?
How about if I get some time to think about that?
You won't hurt my feelings either way.
Yeah.
Okay.
It may be that this is going to be one of those things that we uncover through time.
Okay.
As opposed to being able to say today, all this right. is what the impacts would be.
Yeah.
And I think it really will help when we get some feedback from these people who are requesting service as to what types of products they're interested in.
And I believe I added on via email to you another question as it relates to that. As it relates to our incremental hydro availability for I-937 compliance?
We don't have that on the list. I do remember that. We'll add that to the list.
Which one are you doing? I haven't looked at it yet.
We definitely have I-937 compliance issues on our list for risk management. Question came up about advantages and disadvantages to a moratorium approach. We're still working on that to make sure that we understand how that might work. You heard from Mike about the fiber system capacity, so you have the answer to that. Kelly is working on the question around lost generation and how it relates to the insurance payments that we've been made that have been made. She and I are also working together on options for increasing the board designated reserve fund, because you asked for us to give you some options around that. The only other item I would just mention, this is from a previous board meeting, is that you heard today the report that the Voting Rights Act is moving ahead. So this is a conversation I know between you and Eric, and I just note that that doesn't look like it's going away. In fact, as I heard it today, it's on the governor's vote desk for a choice as to whether to sign or not. And I suspect that that would be signed. So that may lead to some issues that we may need to address.
Would that take place immediately?
Probably
July 1.
So, the effective date is typically July 1 unless there's another date specified. But no, I don't see that that would be something that would be an immediate need to address. It would depend. I mean, some of that we don't control, right? So if someone were to make a request, we would have to take some action.
Right. But I guess my question is, would it affect the 2018 election or would it be the next one?
How about no. if we take that as a...
Yeah.
As the next.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm happy to visit with you offline on that. Okay.
That's it for action item.
Okay. So, and that covers delegation also. Today's?
No, not today's.
Okay.
So, got a few from today. Some interest in a commissioner visit, Commissioner Arso visit to the Skaha Hatchery.
I was going to actually meet with you first before we kick that ball down the field. So.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. We want to look into the county road work at Eagle Creek, make sure that we understand what's happening there, whether there's anything that there's an opportunity to take advantage of. And then just some follow-up on this Voting Rights Act issue as to what implications there are.
Okay.
That's it.
See, no public remaining. It's difficult to have additional public comment. And so any other matters of general business to come before the commission?
Commissioners, we do have one. So I passed out, actually, I think probably Rebecca, I've already included in your packet, perhaps. The motion, this is a motion setting a few special meetings that's coming. You have the general, the MIDSE meeting, the strategy partner meeting, and the tri-commission meeting. All those dates and locations have been now established.
Mr. President.
Mr. Smith.
I would move that we set the following special meetings. March 12, 2018 at 5:30 p.m. at My Lee Thai, 595 Grant Road, East Wenatchee, for the purpose of a Mid-C Commissioners and General Managers Dinner. April 12, 2018 at 7 a.m. at the Confluence Technology Center, 285 Technology Way, for the purpose of holding a strategy partner meeting. And June 5, 2018, 1 p.m. at the
Confluence Technology Center, 285 Technology Center Way, for the purpose of holding a tri-commission meeting.
Okay. Is there a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to establish three special meetings. Is there any discussion? Hearing none. Those in favor of the three meetings as described, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion is carried.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you.
And then the executive session. Length of time, approximately.
I think an hour.
Okay. So we will take a 5-minute recess. Are we okay with that? And start at 2:55. That would be a 7-minute recess. To go into an executive session to discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement actions, litigation, or potential litigation to which the district or its board is or likely to become a party and or legal risk as authorized by RCW 42.30.1101I to plan or the strategy or the position to be taken during the course of collective bargaining as authorized by RCW 42.30.1404B, and to consider the selection of a site or the acquisition of real estate by lease or purchase when the public knowledge regarding such consideration would cause a likelihood of an increased price as authorized by RCW 42.30.111B for approximately 1 hour. So we should be going into the session at about 5 minutes to 3 and ending at approximately 5 minutes to 4. With that being said, let's take a 5-minute break and return to start at 2:55. This is Chelan County Board of Commissioners. We have been in executive session. We came out on time at 5 minutes to 4. Our discussion is incomplete, so we're going to go back into session and finish by 4:30. Chelan County Board of Commissioners coming out of executive session on March 5th, 2018. It is now 4:17 p.m. No decisions were reached. No votes were taken. Is there any other items to come before the commission? Hearing none, we're adjourned.